during the interim time frame between when we publish our report and when we publish the next report, which is actually due in 2013. We are trying to expand our usability of the data and not just do the comprehensive report, but also we've given you the three folios we've done so far, and I'm here to give you one on seniors this today. There's lots of good data in here about seniors. Not surprising that we have our population is growing in that demographic. 13% of the seniors in our survey indicated they did not have at least $300 in savings, and half stated they were worse off economically this year than last year. I doubt that is a surprise. Transportation is getting to be a bigger and bigger issue with seniors. But on the other hand, they feel they're safe in their neighborhoods. Most of them own their own homes. 2 out of 5 volunteer in their community. So there's good things to be said about our community and our senior population. We've issued this in October because of the senior forum that's coming up on October 21st, and I know the board has supported this, and I hope to see you all there for that. It promises to be a very interesting and special day. In addition to what we've been doing with our folios, we also have done some GIS mapping of some of the data, and most recently we've put up PowerPoints on our website that has data points on each section of the report, and they're user-friendly, and we encourage them to be used by members of the community who could use that data to do whatever presentation they're doing. So with that, I have these things for you, and our next folio is going to be entitled Healthy Community Development, which has been a challenging one, I can say, to do. And then our last folio will be community assets, and we have a lot of those as well. So I'll be seeing you again when those two or one, the community development one, is ready. Thank you much.
Ms. Hughes, if you could hold on just a second. Supervisor Gibson has a question.
It's actually a comment, and we want to thank all those involved in Action for Healthy Communities for the survey work that they do. And in particular, coming out with that senior folio right now, and I was just wondering if you could maybe hype that senior symposium a little bit that's coming up on the 21st. The survey work you do really does inform a lot of discussion that's going to go on the 21st from 9 to 3 at the Courtyard Marriott, but maybe Susan could just give a little expansion of where we're headed there.
Yeah, it's the first ever, I guess, senior symposium to be held on Friday, October 21st. And this is what it says. More than 100 community leaders and stakeholders will participate in the first senior symposium. SLO 2025 is an interactive community event designed to bring community leaders and stakeholders together to explore the long-term critical issues around around healthy aging in San Luis Obispo County. So the neat thing I think about it is it is very interactive. It's not going to be one of these things where people are just talking at you. The people who attend are going to be actively participating. The keynote speaker is Jim Emmerman. He's Executive Vice President, Civic Ventures, and from 2005 to 2008, Mr. Emmerman was a Civic Ventures Vice President directing the Purpose Prize for 17 years prior to joining Civic Ventures. He worked at the American Society on Aging, the largest association of professionals working with and on behalf of older adults. So it does promise to be a very informative day, and I'm sure this won't be this first one will be followed by another in another year.
And again, we thank Action for bringing forward a lot of the issues in that survey are things that are going to be talked about in more length. So commend both enterprises to you.
Thank you, Susan.
Mr. Greening, followed by Gwen Taylor, please.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and I very much appreciate the news we just received. What Ms. Hughes says about transportation, the typical senior will lose the ability to drive their car and have about 9 more years of life. Most of those years they will be able to use and depend on fixed route transit service, and then they will need paratransit. And so we need to keep those transportation issues in the foreground. We're not talking about special, unusual people when we're talking about the folks who need public transit. We're talking about all of us later in our lives. Well, I have a rather heavy topic to go to here. And first, I'd like to thank Chair Hill for being present at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission meeting yesterday and for speaking. They are at the very beginning of an EIS process. They're not yet at the scoping. That will probably be the next phase, relative to dispensing with the illusion that there's a place ready to take the nuclear waste that's accumulating there. Yucca Mountain is just permeable desert sand. We're not going to throw any more billions after the billions that have already been thrown. We don't have to worry about transporting stuff there. We don't have the failure of responsibility of thinking we can just shift it into someone else's backyard. That means it's piling up here. It's piling up in the spent fuel pools, which have been multiply re-racked to a higher density, and the casks are beginning to appear in the so-called dry storage. And I think it's important for this county to participate as a county to hold hearings prior to the next phase with the NRC to start collecting ideas about what are we going to do. We're talking about durations now of not just 60 years, but maybe centuries that we can expect it to be in our own backyards. And I think one thing to reflect on is, do we expect our current civilization to last for centuries or even decades in its present form? Take the rate at which we are currently disinvesting in education. If that was a trend line and we were just going to extrapolate it, won't be many decades before we will have no technocrats that can even pretend to be able to handle this stuff. But there are still likely to be people around, not to mention the animals. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? It's accumulating now. Never mind talk of relicensing. It's accumulating now. I think this is a county issue, and we need to have hearings to prepare county positions for the NRC. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Ms. Taylor, followed by Ben DeFada.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I'm a resident of Los Osos in the Prohibition Zone. There is a continued need for Supervisor Gibson to alert the public of Los Osos that the water basin is being overdrafted. The ISJ has not been adjudicated, and the continued cost for the ISJ work program, three tasks in which the assessment district and the Los Osos CSD are paying the cost, is continuing. For 1 year alone, the cost to the CSD for Cleith Harris was $29,767. This was in 2010. The Wallace Group was $17,706 plus an estimated $500 per month for the Wallace Group's representation to the ISJ. This is just a superficial overview as to the costs of the ISJ in 2009 and 2010. Costs for the ISJ are not stopping. The recession has not ended for many in the Prohibition Zone, yet there are costs of living increase. There is no definitive answer to the cost of the sewer, plus the ancillary costs, such as the basin management plan for the whole community financed by those in the assessment district. Those in Golden State Water District have already been noticed of an increase in water rates to offset the cost to Golden State Water. The legal representative for Golden State Water Company cost the CSD for 1 month, $1,512. Remembering the Los Osos CSD is not the only entity in this cost sharing of the ISJ. How much is this ISJ costing, and how is the cost sharing being shared? This, alone with many other questions, are subjects that Supervisor Gibson and his sewer team need to be ready to answer at a town hall meeting, and soon, better than later. The proposed update on the sewer project has little information, such has the location been secured for the sewer project? Have the easements been agreed upon? Have the requirements for the different agencies been approved or evaluated for approval? Has the monitoring pumps for nitrate testing in all testing wells as required by the regional board been set up? They requested it. They did not require it. They requested it. Are you above a request? Questions are unending, but answers are silence. Napoleon Bonaparte is
Thank you,
quoted.
Ms. Taylor. Mr. DeFatto, followed by Al Barrow, please.
Good morning, Chairman Hill, Board, Sheriff, fellow taxpayers, Ben DeFatto from Los Osos. From day one, when Noel King says, stop your bitching, gravity is what you're going to get, there was never going to be anything else. Then when Pablo Ogred got involved with the most antiquated, overpriced, unaffordable, energy hog, stinking sludge maker gravity collection project on down the line to this present day where this county has never bothered to look at cheaper, better technology alternatives to Ogred and Kelly's pillow talk conflict of interest saga. I have never seen an investigation report given during a morning comment period after the five of us used up our 3 minutes on other comments. We were not even allowed to comment in the afternoon after the closed session report by your counselor. That's normally done according to the Brown Act. It appears that evidence that the public offered was never looked at, or a request from the public to submit evidence and provide interviews from the public was never asked for. In fact, phone calls and emails were never answered or returned by Mr. Grant. Where's our representatives? It appears that questions and answers that were asked to Ogren and Kelly were used for Mr. Grant's report and nothing else. Was Ogren asked to take an oath? Probably not. Occasionally, Mrs. Kelly came up to these microphones and said, you're doing a good job. Continue on with this expensive gravity collection and ever, even telling some of us, quote, I don't care what it costs and how many homeowners and renters will have to move out of town, end of quote. Were questions asked of her like, was she ever on the county's payroll? Or was she ever on anybody's payroll? Ever ask your five-year-old kid holding a hammer in his hand if he put that dent in your car? And you asked him, did you do that? And his answer was, no, I did not do that. Well, that's just what happened here in this investigation. Remember, there's no statute of limitations on this kind of behavior. Chairman Hill, these are illegal questions that could undermine your board's credibility involving the dismissal of these allegations against these two. Chairman Hill, you and your board are guilty of abusing your political powers against the poor, disabled, low- and middle-income people. In fact, everyone that resides in the Prohibition Zone. This is hurtful hatred by you and this little community. You have purposely avoided saltwater intrusion studies, seismic activity studies, and affordability studies. You're even afraid to hold a town hall meeting in Los Osos because you don't want to wake up a sleeping town. Well, after seeing their new assessments charges, the town is waking up. Why couldn't you just ask for a proposal to get the crap from here to there and save us $50 to $100 million? Cheaper is a lot of money. Going back to the power plant, nuclear power plant, you don't even know where to dispose of stuff. And to go out in the desert, you got the rat out there, the butterflies out there. But here where we have the people, oh, build the damn thing.
Thank you, Ben.
Could you put that up on the screen for me, please?
Mr. Barrow, followed by Richard Margetson, please.
Thank you, gentlemen. My name is Al Barrow, Coalition for Low-Income Housing. Up on the screen today, we have a slide, and I showed it last week, and I showed it at the CSD. This is a picture of Los Osos. It's an aerial photograph, and this end is our valley where we have our farming, and it's the eastern portion of our aquifer. It's called the creek compartment. Our aquifer extends underneath us in A, B, C, and D horizons. The A horizon is shaped like this, and it's a perch clay lens that's slightly permeable, but it holds water, and it's about 8 to 10 feet below the grade, and it's about 2 feet thick. This line out here goes out to where our aquifer was out here 20 years ago. That lower aquifer has receded and been overpumped until it's come into this area about in here. That's saltwater intrusion in this whole area here. And that's in our zone C, which is our, zone D, which is our lower aquifer. This line right here is the limits of our aquifer that's confined by the Franciscan Rock Formation, which is a geological formation. And it's very much hooked up, this whole system here. It's a very small aquifer that we depend upon for our future. The faults are offshore here that we've been describing. It's called the shoreline fault, and then there's a Hosgree fault, and they come together in a kind of a triangle off the picture. And they also join with, whoops, sorry about that. They join with this formation, which is Los Osos Strand A fault, which is a 6.8 magnitude fault, which is three times the fault that was done in Paso Robles. Three times the magnitude. Gentlemen, Mr. Gibson says that he's a seismologist, but he needs to get up to speed on this because there's been a lot of work done lately by the USGS, and they're coming out with a new summary of fault risks. The main point I'm making here is this is all high groundwater. There's high groundwater around the bay here, and we're going to have a huge time if we put in a gravity sewer with trenching, which is going to be open most of the time. The pipes are going to be full of air most of the time, and they will float if there is an earthquake. This is all mapped liquefaction zone right here. Very foolish move to put in a gravity sewer when you can directional drill a small bore, small diameter, low pressure collection system. And you guys have a great day with the finances. Good luck.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow. Mr. Margetson, followed by Lindy Owen, please.
Thank you.
Richard Margetson. Last Thursday, the Los Osos Community Service District had a presentation from the ISJ group led by Rob Miller, the CSD district engineer, on where we are with the basin management plan and the Madawas water conservation and water demand analysis. It was probably 2 hours of presentation, questions, comments, rebuttal, additional questions. It was a very good, informative meeting. Representatives from Golden State Water, the other major water purveyor in the community, was there. But what was interesting is, after all this time of the ISJ ramping up for this presentation, getting on the same page and finding consensus on what they were going to release to the public, there was no member from county staff, the county, or the Board of Supervisors at this meeting. And I think of everything that's happened in the last year, this is probably the meeting you wanted to be at. We found out some very interesting information on Thursday. The analysis actually has some flaws in it. Currently, the Los Osos CSD, who, according to Mr. Gibson, who has not been impressed with the water rate structure or the conservation efforts of the Los Osos CSD, last fiscal year consumed 228 million gallons. We found out on Thursday that the census data states that that district has approximately 7,100 residents, which works out to gallons per capita per day of 88 gallons. I don't know that there's many communities in this county that are down to 88, indoor, outdoor, combined. And that number, the 228 million, gentlemen, includes the schools in that water district, the commercial bed and breakfast, and all of the commercial properties in that district. That's all part of that 228 million gallons. If you subtract that, this 88 per capita is much lower than that. There's also some problems with the analysis of how much water savings is going to come from this plan. You're going to have some issues down the road. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Margeson. Ms. Owen.
Good morning. Lindy Owen from Los Osos. I wanted to discuss the very large investigation that was done, one sheet, two sides, on this conflict of interest, which basically there is a very clear line of wrongdoing that connects activities that Pava Ogren has done with members of the community, in particular Maria Kelly, who had a prominent position on the CSD, the Los Osos CSD, and made decisions that affected the project, whether this investigation wants to accept that or not. I wanted to read first by an article from 2007, June, by David Snead, and just a little comment that was put in the middle of an article about the Nacimiento pipeline. And he said, large multi-agency public works projects sometimes have cost thresholds as a way for participants to get out of the project if bids substantially exceed engineers' estimates. Bids for a controversial sewer system in Los Osos came in double the estimates, and that was one reason a subsequent Community Services District Board abandoned the project. It came in double with Montgomery Watson Harza, the people that we are back in bed with. Then I want to go back to the investigative news source that Mr. Grant chose to downplay, CalCoastNews.com, and I would like to read from part of their investigation here. Speaking about Maria Kelly, it says her former husband, Sean Kelly, said that Pava Ogren would tell...
Ms. Owen, we don't want you making personal attacks on people during our public comment. We do not allow personal attacks on individuals during public comment. Ms. Owen, I would ask that you have a seat, please. You are losing your time.
I am losing time. Thanks to your goodness. Ogren was temporarily running the Los Osos District. Montgomery Watson Park was temporarily back on by the District for Wastewater Project Management early September 1995. Prior to the work of the district, Ogren had worked for a subcontractor. He did not sign the contract nor did any board member. Instead, Ogren waited several weeks before the new school began to stand in the
We're closing public comment. Thank you. You don't have the right to a point of order, Ms. Owen. I know that you think that behaving rudely is advancing your causes. It's not. We're going to move on. Thank you, please. All right. Madam Clerk, we're going to go to our first hearing item. Actually, I wanted to point out, too, that we do have hearing devices available if people need them. You can check in with us, and we'll be happy to provide them. Madam Clerk.
A1, an annual update regarding the county's fiscal forecast.
It didn't sound right, but we'll, But we'll go to first to Mr. Grant.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim Grant, County Administrator. Before we get into the item today on the finances, I did want to make one comment regarding a bill that the governor signed on Sunday that does help us in our finances, and that's AB 1016. That was sponsored by Assemblyman Kachu Asajian, former supervisor, that provides reimbursement for our DA and our courts regarding inmates at the Atascadero State Hospital. This particular piece of legislation is important to us because in the past we've received somewhere in the neighborhood between $500,000 to $600,000 a year in reimbursement. And a new way of looking at it, the state decided that maybe we weren't due that that money. This legislation was written to help us get past that, and in fact it was successful. And it was successful on a large part because of our assemblyman, but also with the help of our district attorney, Gerald Che, did a great job of working with Sacramento and the controller's office and many other parts of Sacramento to get this legislation passed, as well as Paul Yoder from Peterson and Associates, our lobbyist in Sacramento. Both did a fabulous job, spent hours and hours working this legislation through. It was budgeted this year in this budget for $600,000. It's in next year's budget for another $600,000. So if we hadn't got this legislation passed, we would have started out with a hole. So I just wanted to comment that the system worked for us, and we're happy to announce that that legislation has been signed by the governor. So with that, we'll get into our fiscal forecast for the day. The forecast has been written by Assistant County Administrator Dan Buckshy, and he will be giving the details of that. But just a high-level discussion on that is that we are entering into our fifth year of our budget gaps, our seven-year pain plan. And over the last 4 years, we've had gaps of $18 million, $30 million, $17 million, and this year, a little over $11 million. Next year, we're making progress, and it'll be somewhere in probably the $6 to $7 million range. Details will be provided in a moment. So I just want to state that the fiscal policies of the board have been working for us with the help of department heads and the help of all of our employees. Everybody's tightening the belt, and we are making progress into getting structurally balanced. We think another couple of years we'll do it, we hope. But again, we are at the mercy of both the federal and the state budgets, and you know that they're not in good shape. And so our forecast, it focuses on the general fund today. Our general fund is really half funded by state and federal revenue. So again, there's a lot of we're making assumptions, and we're going to run with those. We've been successful over the last couple of years, but we never know. I just want to put that out there that it's a crapshoot lots of times in terms of where we're going to end up. Additionally, again, we are focused on the general fund, and we're not looking at other funds right now, although we do look at that during the budget time, such as roads and libraries and parks and those types of things. They're not a general fund department, so we look at those on a separate level. So today we'll have the presentation by Mr. Buckshy, and we'll start that in just a moment. And then actually we're going to enter after that discussion. We'll talk about public safety realignment and then get into the afternoon session regarding some planning issues, a progress report, and some priorities. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dan. Thank you.
Mr. Buckshy.
Okay. Good morning. So for the outline for this morning's presentation on the forecast, I thought I'd start out with overall economic conditions and trends, take a look at this past year as well as what we're anticipating for the future. Then I'll dive into the details of our specific general fund forecast and can pause for any discussion that your board would like to have, and then we'll revisit your board's priorities that have been in place for a few years and hold any discussion to see how you want to set those for the upcoming year. So with that, in a nutshell, I feel like we're beginning to sound like a broken record here. The economy has not changed all that much the past few years. We're winding
our... help with these graphics? Tell us.
I do. All right. Penny Bersihaga is our special effects expert here, so she gets the credit for that. Things have not changed. We're continuing to work our way through our plan, and you'll see a lot of these slides are... from prior years, because things haven't changed that much. So that being said, let's start off with the high points, that the economy has improved. That is an important point. It hasn't improved by much, but it's a lot better than continuing to degrade or be completely flat. So that is something to emphasize. Things are improving, albeit slowly. And then more specifically for us, that the budget goals and policies and balancing strategies that your board has adopted and implemented, and that county departments and employees at all levels of the organization have been implementing the last few years, they are working. And as a result, the county's budget gap is shrinking according to plan. As Mr. Grant noted, we're looking at around a $6.5 million gap for this upcoming year, which is considerably smaller than we were just a couple years ago when we were at $30 million in 2009-10. So that's the good news. I'd start off with, or early on here, take a look back over what's occurred over the past year. And some things are the same, some things have changed. Unemployment does remain high nationally. It's around a 9.5%. Locally, we're a little bit worse off, around 10 to 10.5% in the state. We have one of the higher unemployment rates in the country at about 12.5%. And that has not been ticking down despite many efforts to get people back into the workforce. And many folks are forecasting it'll be at least 3 to 5 more years before unemployment comes down to more historic normal levels. Stock markets are lower than they have been, and I think the latter point is more important, that things are more volatile. The market dropped back and hit its low point in recent times in the spring of 2009. Through the latter portion of 2009 and 2010, the market grew considerably, and now in 2011, we're off a bit. And there have been a lot of swings here the last few months, and I think it's because people are uncertain about where the economy is headed. Are we really improving? Are we through the worst of things, or darker times lie ahead? And so the market is trying to find its ground. As I noted earlier, the economy did grow. And then this fourth point is one that's not economic at all, but it's having large economic impacts, is the political polarization in Washington. There was a recent study I thought was kind of interesting that I read that shows that as economic disparity occurs, the gap between the wealthy, if you will, and those who are relatively poor, and as the middle class is eroded, when that's occurred over time, political polarization increases, and that as there's a lack of a middle class, there's a lack of a middle ground, politically speaking, that seems to be playing out here. I think the culmination was the U.S. A debt ceiling issue in discussion that occurred in August. That's typically a ministerial act to raise the debt ceiling to match the budget. The budget had been passed several months prior. The raising the debt ceiling would have simply allowed that budget to be implemented. And as we all know, that played out for quite some time. As a result, Standard & Poor's reduced the U.S.'s debt rating from AAA to AA+. The other two rating agencies held it at AAA, but have a negative outlook going forward, which sets the stage for potential future downgrades. Now, a lot of folks have said that was unwarranted, and S&P's caught a fair bit of flack, but the fundamentals weren't so much technical as they were related to their perception that Washington is not effectively dealing with the issues at hand, that they could be dealt with from a technical standpoint, but they're not being dealt with, and that was a big driver of the downgrade. So looking at current macroeconomic conditions, this slide is the exact same as the last 2 years, actually. Record national debt, we're up to $14.8 trillion of debt, which is about $132,000 per taxpayer. The federal budget deficit is about $1.3 trillion. This is the ongoing operating budget. So, you know, we have a $6.3 million gap. The feds have a $1.3 trillion gap, a little bit bigger issue to deal with there. Housing market continues to struggle. Credit is tight, even though interest rates are at historic lows. The 30-year mortgage dropped below 4% for the first time in, since these types of records have been kept, yet the housing market remains weak. One of the things that I think will be a challenge going forward is when interest rates do start to pick up, what does that mean for the housing market? Clearly, the refinancing industry, which has been quite busy for some time, I would imagine would dry up as rates start to rise, and then what will that do to the housing market longer term? And then the last point, unemployment remains high, as I already spoke to. Consumer spending is what I want to talk about for a moment. I've mentioned that it's light. It has been here locally, but nationally, as a percent of income, folks are spending to comparable levels to more historic norms. Spending dropped a fair bit during the recession through 2007 to 2009, but it's picked up a bit, and as a percentage of income, it is in what would be considered historically normal. So a challenge there is that consumer spending probably isn't going to get us out of this situation. We're probably going to have to focus more on exports, which is a bigger challenge given the United States cost structure at this point. So we'll see. You know, the flip side is consumers could go into debt and buy a lot more, but longer term, I'm not sure that's the appropriate way to go. So some signs of improvement here, continuing with macroeconomic conditions. There has been some growth, as I mentioned. Gross domestic product increased by about 1.5%, which obviously is better than negative growth. However, in a post-recessionary period, this is slow. Normally, the economy rebounds much more quickly after the end of the recession. So by relative terms, we're kind of just grinding our way through this. Slight housing market improvement. Things are picking up a bit. Those who can qualify are buying. So we are seeing a slight uptick. And then corporate profits are high. Many are holding records levels of cash and waiting to invest, but it seems that corporations are reluctant to really invest some of their cash reserves until they know where the economy is headed and that it would be a wise investment. So we'll want to track that more closely as well. So I wanted to dive into housing. As we know, this was the primary driver, the housing bubble and the subsequent bursting of that bubble, or the big driver for why we're in the current economic situation we are nationally. You can see here about 50 million homes have mortgages. About 14.5 are worth less than what they were purchased for, meaning the homeowner is underwater, so to speak. About 3.5 million are seriously delinquent, behind on their payments, and a little over 5 million have been foreclosed or were sold in distress, likely a short sale. So the takeaway from this is that, as you can see in this last bullet, a little more than half are in good shape, which means a little less than half are not in good shape. About 10% have been foreclosed or a short sale. 3.5 are struggling to keep their homes. And then their 14.5, I think, is important as well. These are the folks that bought a home but don't have equity, and it would be difficult for them to sell and move upward. You know, a lot of folks, as their families grow, move into a bigger home, or they want a nicer home as their careers advance. A lot of these folks aren't able to do that because they're likely unable to sell their current house and take the hit in equity that would occur. Looking nationally, in terms of foreclosure rates, you can see here the states in red have the highest foreclosure rates. Unfortunately, California is in the mix here. And not too surprisingly, the states that had the biggest boom now have the biggest busts. California, Nevada, Arizona, and Florida were the states where the big booms occurred, and now we're seeing the drop. You can see here in Nevada, 1 in 20 homes have been foreclosed or in foreclosure. This is a chart that we've looked at periodically over the years, and it's one that I thought was important to bring back. We haven't looked at it in this forecast in a couple years. It's a little hard to read. I apologize for that. But what this does is it goes back to 1890 and adjusts housing prices to that level, adjusting for inflation. So the average price being 100 would be the baseline, if you will. And you can see in the 1920s to 1940s, that dropped considerably during the Great Depression to about 70% level. It's since that time, World War II and beyond, it obviously increased dramatically, and then has hovered around that 100, that mean level there. And you can see on the far right side, in around 2000 through 2005, it spiked up to over 200, which is twice the historical norm. Now, we've pulled back dramatically, obviously, since that time, but a key point is that we're still at 118, according to this, that we're still overpriced compared to the long-term normal for housing, which means that prices are likely to drop for another couple of years until we get to that historic norm. Hopefully, we don't drop below the historic norm as happened in prior decades. Another discussion point is the national debt. As I mentioned earlier, it's been a big source of discussion what to do. There are many who think it's time for austerity measures and that it's time to rein in spending and tackle the budget deficit and the national debt. Others think that the government should play a more active role and spend more in order to help prop up the economy. This is probably hard to see on the smaller screen, but what this shows is the impact of some key policy decisions. You can see here there are the Bush administration-era tax cuts in the gold, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan in red. And then below that are issues related to the economic downturn as well as recovery measures. And the point from this slide is that the tax cuts and the wars account for half of the debt. And so there are many who look at that and think, what are the big drivers of the debt? the downturn economically certainly is important, but relative to the other factors at play, it's not that big of an impact. If it were that alone, it would be more manageable. So we'll see how this plays out in the future with respect to the discussion of how to tackle the deficit going forward in the balance of taxes versus additional cuts. Which brings us back to the same slide from last year in terms of to spend or not to spend, and what will the government do going forward. Again, looking forward, it is a little cloudy. As I mentioned earlier, stock markets have been choppy here the last couple months. It's because of the level of uncertainty. I put this cover up here from The Economist magazine for a reason. This is, I believe, the August 6th issue. And in it, they evaluated the likelihood of a double-dip recession at 50%. So economists are largely torn on this. Many do believe that the worst is behind us and we'll slowly grow our way out. Others believe that we're going to dip back. And clearly, there's no certain answer at this point in time. So the key takeaway from an economic, macroeconomic perspective is that conditions are improving, but unfortunately not by much. So we're continuing to plot our way through this. So next phase, I'll move a little closer to home and talk about the state budget.
Dan, absolutely. Supervisor Meacham has a question.
If I could, Dan, and I don't know if you're prepared to do this, but a lot for the listening audience and folks out there, a lot of folks keep hearing about the effects of Europe in terms of default from Greece, things like that. Can you briefly touch on how that impacts the United States and why?
Yeah, briefly, that'll start to test the limits of economic knowledge there.
But, I mean, and the 50% from The Economist, that's like asking what's the stock market going to do today? Well, it's going to go up or it's going to go down.
You know? Right. Well, you know, I think the big focus on Europe and the potential impact here is that we are in a global economy these days, and that much of the investment of U.S. Corporations and business is global. And if there were to be a big downturn in Europe, it could impact business here as well. The risk is the banking sector, similar to what happened here. There are a lot of risky loans that were taken. The banks are at risk in many portions of Europe, as well as state government. Obviously, there's been a lot of focus on Greece, Ireland, Portugal, to name a few, and whether or not they can withstand the downturn, and then whether the likes of Germany and France and some others can come in and bail them out. So the euro, you know, combining currency has made that a little more challenging than what it might have been in the past. So I think in sum, the risk is that if there were a major downturn here, because the world is so connected these days, it would have a ripple effect through throughout our country and other countries throughout the world.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure. Okay, so coming back to the state budget, you know, I do want to give the state some credit. I don't do that often. This past year, the state did tackle a fairly significant portion of its budget gap. It had about a $25 billion gap this past year. A good portion of it was closed with ongoing sustainable measures. There was less use of short-term gimmicks and tricks, if you will. That being said, still looking at about $10 to $15 billion, if I had to wager a guess, for 12-13. A couple things come into play. The Prop 1A loan that trigger was pulled a few years ago, that needs to be paid back in 12-13. So that's, I believe, $2.5 to $3 billion that's added to the gap that wasn't there. That was a short-term measure from a few years ago they now have to deal with. additionally, the state controller just released a report yesterday. Year-to-date, state revenues are about 4% behind schedule. As many of you will likely recall, towards the end of the state's budget process, they were still $4 to $5 billion out and couldn't get there. So what they did is they pumped up revenues by $4 billion and said if they don't materialize, trigger cuts would take effect. That range was if state revenues were between $1 and $3 to $4 billion under budget, then the triggers would take effect. So right now it looks as if at least the first wave of triggers would be affected. The state finance director has to make that call in late December as to forecasting how revenues will look for the rest of the year. The reason this report yesterday was important is a lot of the corporate profits were reported and are reflected in September, and they were not nearly as strong as what was included in the budget. For us locally, what that means, if the first round of trigger cuts is related primarily to schools, K through 12, and then higher education, The second round would largely impact social services, particularly the in-home supportive services program, and then to a lesser extent, libraries. I say to a lesser extent because it's less dollars. It's an important amount to a library, but compared to the dollar impact to social service, it would be less. So we'll be watching that closely between now and December. Hopefully revenues rebound a bit between now and then, but it seems likely that at least the first level of triggers will take effect. The next point I do want to emphasize, when I was thinking about the forecast and what are the biggest risks to us as a county, you know, I think we're fairly well situated. We've dealt with a large downturn already. If we continue to plod through the general economy as we have, I think we can manage that. The biggest risk in my mind is the state budget and realignment concerns. You're going to hear in the presentation next about AB 109. That's the first phase of realignment. We're going to hear a lot more of realignment. In addition to public safety, numerous health programs and numerous social services programs are being realigned, and quite frankly, it hasn't been worked out yet. Still working through all the funding scenarios. And the risk that I do want to highlight is the responsibilities transferred for AB 109. As of 10 days ago, we've now assumed responsibility for those in state parole and in some of the state prison that we were not responsible before, and we'll be speaking about that again here in the next presentation. However, the revenues are uncertain. We have funding for the current year, and the governor has tried in earnest to secure funding in future years by means of a constitutional amendment or guaranteed funding, but has not been successful in getting that through the legislature. So this is something we'll be working with, you know, closely with CSAC, with our lobbyists, and counties throughout the state are watching this closely. I believe the governor actually met with the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors in closed session to hear out their concerns related to this issue. Obviously, it's a big impact for our county. It can be a tremendous impact for a county the size of Los Angeles. You know, and the last point to emphasize is that because schools and cities are the highest level on the trigger, schools anyway, they filed a lawsuit challenging the way that realignment was funded for the current year. It remains to be seen how that could play out. So not only do we not have a guarantee for future years, the current year's funding could be at risk, or at least the methodology, depending how these lawsuits play out. Next point on the state budget, and unfortunately this is not showing up as well as I had hoped on the monitor. But this points out, it looks at all 50 states and what their budget gaps are as a percent of their overall budget. In California, it's a 30%. The gap is 30% of its overall budget. A couple others that are high. New Jersey is 37%. Texas, which I find interesting because there's a lot of talk of how the economy in Texas has been robust and a lot of jobs have been added. Well, their state government is struggling. They have a $13.5 billion budget gap, which is 31% of their overall budget. The national average, and this is the key point for us in California, the national average is about 17%. We're at about 30%, so we're almost double the national average of what that gap is. And that's why it's been so difficult. To put this in perspective, our budget gap for the upcoming year is 1.6%. If it were 30% like the states, it would be $113 million we would have to close this year instead of $6.5 million. So that's why it's so difficult for the state to close this gap, because it is so large. So moving on, looking at local conditions, same slide again as last year. The housing market is stabilizing a bit. The lower end is seeming to hopefully have found a bottom and is improving a bit. But the mid and higher end, if you have $1 million, it's a great time to buy a house in this county, because that market is still slow and you get a lot more house than what you used to for that price. Consumer spending here has been relatively flat. Our sales tax and our transient occupancy taxes, they're stable, they're not declining, but they're certainly not increasing, so we're projecting those flat. And then I spoke to the state budget concerns. Looking around the state, how do we fare in terms of our assessed value in property taxes? You can see these are many of our comparables for demographic purposes. Sonoma was about minus 2%. Santa Cruz, Monterey, Ventura were all relatively flat. Santa Barbara saw an increase of about 1.5%. Kings, 1% increase. And then we were minus 1.9%, just under 2%. So we're a little behind in the recovery in the housing market related to other areas. And the national average, or the California average, statewide average, was flat, a 0.1% increase. So we are lagging a bit. It's been interesting, I think, compared to the state and country, we are a little slower to move into this downturn. I think we're a little slower to pull back out of it. some local statistics that we track and have been reporting on for a number of years now, some key indicators are building permits. Unfortunately, there's not much in the way of signs of life here. The graph that has the boxes on it, that is the value of the construction value of the permits. That is below where we were 13 years ago, and that is not adjusted for inflation. So if it were adjusted for inflation, we'd be considerably less. On the number of permits issued is the gold line. There is a little bit of an uptick there from 10-11 compared to 09-10, but I think that's due to a lot of smaller projects, a lot of remodels and the like. We're starting to see a little more of that, but the larger projects are still not really occurring. Foreclosure trends, something we've been tracking. I always find this slide rather amazing. You go back to 05-06, there were 48 foreclosures in the county. And in 09-10, a mere 4 years later, it was up to 1,500 foreclosures. That's just a dramatic increase. The top line is the notice of default, which is the beginning of the process. That's when folks receive the letter in the mail that says you need to pay up or you'll enter into the foreclosure process. The lower line, the white one, are those that have actually been foreclosed. Now, the good news on this is it's dipping down. The cautionary note related to that is, I'm not certain whether or not it's actually improved out there. The reason being is earlier this year, the feds started investigating banks in terms of their paperwork with respect to foreclosures, and a lot of foreclosures were put on hold while that paperwork issued was worked through. And so now the paperwork issue has been shored up, and it remains to be seen if foreclosures will spike back up a bit or if it's a true downturn. Obviously, let's hope for the latter in that the market's improved and that foreclosures are starting to drop. This next one is interesting as well. This is the percent of homes that go to foreclosures. So this would be those that receive the first notice who then actually proceed to lose their home. And if you go back to 05-06, only 10% actually lost their homes who started that process, which meant that most likely they're able to sell their home and get out of the mortgage. Or if they had lost their job, they could have found a new one, or if they were struggling, maybe they hit into their financial reserves, whatever the case may be, to avoid foreclosure. You can see in 09-10 that jumped up to 70% of folks were losing their home once they started the process, most likely because they couldn't sell it because it was worth less than they bought it, which doesn't help with the mortgage, or two, they lost a job and weren't able to find one. So this just is, a sign of the distress level out there. And again, it ticked down, and hopefully that's a trend that continues. So jumping ahead locally for the forecast assumptions, again, same methodology as prior years. It is focused on the general fund. As Mr. Grant noted, this does not include things such as airports, golf courses, parks, libraries, which are either their own special revenue funds or enterprise funds. This focuses on the lion's share of the budget, which is the general fund. Assumes that we continue to do what we're doing. We don't add anything. And then the last point does assume that any loss of state revenue would be offset with a loss in expenditures. And if not, any dollar for dollar backfill, if you will, would add to the gap. We'll hit on these, a lot of numbers here. I'll just hit on these briefly. Overall revenue, we're forecasting a drop of about 1.5%, so relatively flat in the scheme of things. Non-departmental revenue is flat that we're forecasting at this point in time. This last bullet, I do want to emphasize, does assume no new taxes or tax rate increases. I know SLOCOG is in the midst of conducting a poll or a survey on the attitude towards taxes locally as it relates to transportation, so we may receive some information about how that looks and whether or not anything would be viable into the future. I think their report back is due November or December timeframe, if I recall. Looking at departmental revenue, again, relatively flat. Does include the repayment of the Los Osos wastewater project. And I mentioned the state realignment here because this is really where it would be reflected. The state funding is received for state mandated programs. And so any cutback in state revenue would be reflected in the departmental piece. And then fund balance available is at 18.5. Shifting to the expenditure side, again, relatively flat, a meager increase. Salary and benefits assume no compensation increases for the forecast. Does include a pension rate increase, an assumption of 1%. That assumption does also include that the county would pay 0.5% and that employees would pick up the other half. So the impact to the county budget would be 0.5%. There is 0.5% of pension obligation bond increase built in back in 03, 04, 04, 05. bonds were issued to help shore up the pension to pay off some of the unfunded liability. It was a good move back then. It's a considerably lower interest rate than what we would have had to pay otherwise, but we are continuing to pay that. And then it does assume that workers' compensation rates that were lowered a few years ago would continue. We'll know in a month or two whether or not that's an accurate assumption as additional data will be available, but for now it seems reasonable. Non-salaries included a CPI of 2%. I believe the current CPI is about 2.5%, give or take. And it's difficult. There are those who are worried about inflation, those who are worried about deflation. So we took a reasonable approach, I think, of 2%. Then lastly, assumes a contingency of 4%. As we know, the board's official budget policy is for a 5% contingency. That was lowered during 2009-10 to 4%, intentionally so during this these budgetary times, and the plan is to continue with 4% into the future. So bottom line is that we're looking at about a $6.5 million gap, which, as I noted earlier, is about 1.5% of our operating budget. And you can see the range there of about $5.5 to $9.5 million. And the reason for the range, as you can see on this slide, is a mere 1% variance in assumptions can swing the gap anywhere from $1.5 million to a little over $2 million. And so that sums up the forecast for the specific year. I have a few more slides I want to hit on in terms of the longer term outlook and where we're at and where things stand. So as we've talked about our 7-year pain plan that we're all familiar with at this point, fiscal year 12-13 does represent year 5. And the plan going forward would be to use, according to the plan, 15% of short-term options and 85% longer-term. And you can see here this follows on the heels of significant gaps, the worst year being 2009-10 when we had a $30 million gap. So it is getting smaller. It's going in the right direction, which is really good news. And I do want to emphasize something on fiscal year 14-15 is we look out there and it says that the gap would be minimal. We enter the phase of the new normal. Just as a quick refresher, the new normal was a phrase that was coined by Bill Gross of PIMCO a few years back, and it essentially states that the boom times are probably done for a while, that what we should expect is slow incremental growth. And I think for us what that means is that we should expect, once we get out there, revenues to grow slowly in the 1 to 2, maybe 3% range, probably at the high end. And in looking back at the prior year's forecast, I think this is one element that's proving to be true, that the new normal is becoming our new reality as we go forward, and we're preparing for that. Again, this slide just highlights that we're trying to funnel down the use of the short-term reserves over time so that we achieve the structural balance and have the targeted level of reserve designations as of fiscal year 14-15 moving forward. Skip over this slide. The idea basically is that the gap's closing, and the important point was that we bring the expenditures and revenues into balance. If we just close the gap on the far left of that graph but don't degree with the slope of the graph, if you will, we would perpetually be out of balance. So in summary, bottom line is that things are improving, but clearly not out of the woods yet. Consumer weakness likely to continue, or maybe not weakness, but the current trend is likely to continue. As noted earlier, there is still a chance of a double dip. Bottom line for us is that 2 more years of difficult budgets at least as we move through this. Again, good news is that the difficulty is lessening. So where we're at in terms of next steps, we'll be bringing the budget goals and policies to your board in about a month and a half. And then the heavy lifting begins in the December-January time frame for departments, and then they transfer that to the administrative office where we work on compiling the budget February to April, and the process culminates with budget hearings in mid-June. And with that, I would entertain any other questions or comments you may have.
Thank you, Dan. I think one of the most sobering observations in your report is, at least locally, for folks here locally, is the fact that housing values in our county are now at the 2001 levels, which means that 10 years of what seemed to be accumulated equity in homes have been lost. And, of course, that a lot of that was artificial to begin with, and we see even from the trends you point out that there were years of extraordinary increases, that, and then also on the the transfer tax, there was sometimes as much as 30, you know, what you can only imagine is some serious house flipping going on and speculation in years of 32% transfer tax. But anyway, let me get to some questions from my colleagues. Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And either for Dan or for Jim, I do feel a little bit sad that we got left out. The governor didn't want to meet with us in closed session, but that's okay.
I can do without.
How about, you know, the president? Let's go one better.
I won't go there. My question goes more towards the constant discussion about realignment. And now with the cutback in hours at the court system, I would anticipate that the state may be looking at giving back the courts to the county. If that were to happen, what effect would that have on us from a budgetary standpoint?
Well, the question is if it will happen.
If.
And as the board may be aware, it was some years ago, I don't know the exact number of years ago, where the courts were part of the county, and then that there was realignment essentially where the courts were then part of the state system. And they are struggling right now to balance their budget, and the courts have had to take some extraordinary measures to cut back because I don't believe they had a five-year pain plan, probably, and they were caught unawares and had to make some fairly significant cuts right now. I think it'll be a few years if that happens. I think there'll be quite a bit of discussion at the state level with the administration of the courts, which is really their administrative arm, in terms of reducing the numbers up there in terms of their bureaucracy. And I think if they can get a handle on that, it may stay where it is. And if they can't get a handle on that, then I think there may be some discussion. It's just, I'm just guessing right now that they would move it back.
But it'd be a way. It'd be a way.
I think that's years away.
Thank you.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Buckshot, thank you for a very thorough report, and in terms that we can all understand. I particularly appreciate the graphs that illustrate the conditions currently versus many years ago. It's very informative. I have a question on page 7 of the staff report where you're speaking about the fund balance available and estimating that to be about $18.5 million going in to next year. The majority of that's contingency, assuming we stay at the 4%. But in the report, you say there's the actual non-departmental, and I assume you're speaking of revenue there, was about $1.5 million above what was budgeted. And I'm just curious to know what that additional revenue was and if we can anticipate that going forward.
Yes. So at this point in time, we are projecting about a million and a half higher. At this point, we believe property taxes are on track. The uptick is really related to what I would categorize as kind of one-time catch-up. There was some sales tax revenue that came in that the state had allocated wrongly allocated, and then we're getting it back on this side. And a couple other smaller sales tax related, and I'm looking to Andrea maybe for a little help on this. I don't quite recall the full details, but it was more or less shoring up on a few things that we received from the state that came into non-departmental revenue. So it's really good news for the current fiscal year. Obviously, it helps with fund balance available, but we did not build that uptick, that one-time type of pop, if you will, into 12-13 and beyond, because it really was correcting for prior year adjustments, if you will.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I listen to these outlooks every year, I don't know whether to be depressed that we live in some of the most uncertain economic times that we have, or elated to the fact that we're only struggling with a $6 million gap instead of a $1.3 trillion gap. And sometimes it feels a little more like the latter. I just observe, as you talked about the new normal, something struck me. If we really are looking at low revenue growth over the far out years at 2-3%, which I realize is a guess at this point, that when you think of inflation being in the same zone, we're not going to be making much progress for the foreseeable future in terms of growing what needs to be done in this country. And then there's realignment, and I look forward to the discussion next about how we're going to wrestle with that. Obviously, the uncertainty of its long-term prospects are large, and yet I think there's some opportunity. Similar to realignment, as I look forward, and this is really getting to a little bit of our budget priorities, and I didn't know whether you were going to conduct a separate discussion on that. We're going to reaffirm them. I'm looking at our health and human services side of the county, and thinking that we could usefully do some long-term thinking, or perhaps a little bit longer-term thinking than we have. You know, our health agency has taken a huge series of cuts over recent years as our overmatch, so-called, was reduced. But as I look forward from, say, 2012 and 2013, as it stands now, we're looking at a huge change in health care funding coming in January of 2014 with national health care reform. And that's gonna change the landscape dramatically for the county. Not all of that is known, although I'd be happy for some comments from admin staff or Mr. Hamm on where that goes. And as I've been wrestling with some of the health agency issues myself, I'm wondering whether we need a particular strategy to bridge us, essentially, to that January of 14. You know, we see continuing stress put on our county medical services program, our CMSP, our mental health capabilities are holding their own barely, although, you know, a lot of that is in question. And so I'd be interested in terms of our budget priorities or you know, our budget recommendations, if added to our list of things to do, we might ask for a strategy that does look toward that big change coming forward, and how might we use the financial strength of this county to do the best we can on health care issues between now and then. I didn't know what colleagues' thoughts were on that.
That sounds like a good idea to me. Supervisor Patterson?
Yeah. I have no more questions for staff. I just want to echo Supervisor Gibson's concern. When we take a look at public safety, we don't consider health yet. In our county's mission, health and safety is one of our priorities, and I think it would be of value to have that discussion. I was anticipating having that in November when we come back to actually set our budget priorities to rethink that. Another interesting piece of information related to a different area, and that is our parks and natural resources. I was at a conference a few weeks ago where the resources secretary, John Laird, stated that only $1 billion of the $14 billion resource division budget comes from the general fund, and the rest of it comes from fees. And of course, the resources department includes parks department of water resources. A lot of big ticket items are in there, but only $1 billion of that $14 billion comes from the general fund. The rest comes from fees and from bonds that are all expiring. So we can expect a lot of the support that we've gotten in our natural resources area over the next year or so to decline. Many of the grants that we've received over the past years, in fact, we've recently talked about some grants that we've received to invest in our natural resources in this county, they're going to be going away. So I think as good a physical shape as we are relative to many other counties in the state, we still have some serious issues to consider going forward, health being one of those, but our natural resources investment being another.
Mr. Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, but on Prop 1A, I mean, they have to pay that back, but they can reinstitute that again. They can trigger that once again.
That's correct.
Okay, so they basically pay it back and take it back again. But in regard to public safety, I too am anxious to hear the discussion on the realignment. But I think it's important to recognize that this realignment and the funding that's coming down for this year, there's no continuing guarantee for that, and that basically addresses the impacts to realignment to us currently. This has nothing. This is not going to do anything to increase our public safety manpower or whatever the case we're going to be needing in the future as far as drug enforcement, gang enforcement, stuff like that. So I think that the realignment issue is one thing, but that's totally separate from public safety overall.
Mr. Grant?
Yes, that is absolutely true. This is a one-year funding for public safety realignment, which means they're shifting some of the things that the state did down to the county, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. So, yes, it's very particular right. for that public safety realignment. The other piece I want to touch on right now is what the board has brought up in the discussion, that there are other needs out there for our parks, for our libraries, for health and mental health. The forecast that we have presented today doesn't include increasing any funds for any of those additional services. We're hanging in there. We're doing better closing the gap, but it doesn't address those other issues that your board is interested in. And I don't believe that we're probably going to have the resources to come back and recommend that to your board. We'll find out as we move through the process, and we understand the board's concern. But there's the revenue probably just won't be there. And I will make mention, because I've just talked to Mr. Hamm recently about health and mental health services. And when he goes to his conferences, I think we're the envy of many of the counties there, because we still have an overmatch for those services. So we provide additional services over and above the amount of services that are required, and that does not happen in many other places. And Jeff, if you wanted to chime in, feel free to do so. But what I understand, we're the envy of counties because we're still doing that. To do any more is going to be very difficult at this time. But if that's your board's priorities and you want us to look at that and explore that, we certainly will. But it probably means cuts elsewhere.
We'll come back to that, as Supervisor Patterson said, I think, in November. But, Mr. Buckshot, did you have a...
Yeah, I just wanted to note that as part of the presentation, and we can handle this in November, I wanted to at least introduce it. The priorities, as they've been determined by your board in the past, are here to meet legal mandates, to keep our creditors whole, and then public safety is defined by these four. And maybe the way to go is to introduce it today and then come back when we bring the budget goals and policies and balancing strategies in November. I do want to point out one thing that I think is important, that just to add to what Mr. Grant had noted, that public safety and then health and human services added together are close to 60% of the county budget. And so the challenge is that if those are our highest priorities, trying then to balance the budget given that they comprise such a large portion of it. Not to say that it can't be done, but as Jim noted, it becomes increasingly difficult as the forecast is really looking at best maintaining those services. So we can continue that into November if you'd like. Yeah.
Okay, great. Let me open it up to the public now, and we'll bring it back after that. Two requests to speak and maybe a third coming. Mike Brown, followed by Eric Greening, please.
Mike Brown representing CoLab. Very nice slides. Great presentation. We wish they could be posted with the agenda ahead of time as a separate link from the actual board item, because when you get those big files, if you're working with home computers and stuff, they lug. But thank you very much for that. You know, the board talks about the constraints and squeezing down public safety, health, parks. I think your adopted budget book, or your became the adopted budget, has a lot of information on that. And, of course, the risks inherent in, and I think you'll see in your next item, that on balance, the full year of AB 109 will be around $4 million with not a smidge of state funding. And then some of the other realignment risks out there, and a state that's truly broke. present some real threats to whatever stability is here. But you don't have control over the state. You certainly don't have control over the federal issues or the big economy. So we think that, again, you need to focus on what you can do at the local level within the purview of being a board of supervisors. And basically, for local governments, land use is fiscal destiny. And what is permitted and allowed in the land and related is going to determine how strong you are at the local level. So again, how event restrictions, maybe there shouldn't be so many event restrictions. Maybe you should promote that. It looks like it's a burgeoning industry out there and would help people keep the ranchette or the farm or whatever. And likewise, vacation rentals. And what about these various proposals that restrict development in semi-rural areas and so forth? Then you have major efforts on things like the EnergyWise plan, which certainly has become a confused issue with the commission and its staff saying it's not a regulation or a restriction. And then a number of these other efforts. So again, what we would hope is the board would stop and say, how do we turn this around? What could we do to take these inherent strengths and promote them at least as a stopgap way to deal with these economic uncertainties? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Greening, followed by Kimberly Daniels.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and I also appreciate the presentation. I'm kind of looking at the other end of the telescope from the previous speaker relative to land use. I think the question is not how much we are restricting development in the rural areas, but the question of whether there should be any subsidization of the creation of property rights that do not now exist out there. Property rights are involved with the zoning and the existing parcel structure, and can we afford to encourage more out there when we are having trouble with the fiscal balance of providing the services in that area as it is? Agriculture more than pays for itself, but rural development per se doesn't. Anyway, I wanted to get back to the health issue. I think the idea of bridging the gap to 2014 would be a nice idea if we could count on another shore to the bridge. And I'll get back to that in a moment. But first, I am glad to hear something I've been advocating for some time, which is considering health as part of public safety and as part of that priority. Lives are saved by our health department and by health providers. And so if we can figure out a way to do that, I continue to advocate for it. But I don't think things are necessarily going to get easier in 2014. Number one, the centerpiece of what's supposed to happen in 2014 is the individual mandate that is now before the Supreme Court. Somewhere around June, we will find out if that centerpiece holds or not. If not, the whole thing falls apart. If it does hold, it does not represent universal health care. It does not represent cost containment to any significant degree. It continues to include major roles for insurance companies, major revenue to insurance companies that do not provide health care, essentially carrying dead weight in our health care system. I continue to believe that the opposite shore of the bridge, if it's going to be firm and hold that bridge, has to be a single-payer system. We're not going to get it nationally. But if Washington doesn't interfere, we can get it on the state level, and that needs to be front and center in our legislative platform, with the state to get it enacted and with Washington to not interfere with our being a pilot project for the rest of the country, to show that that is truly the way to find economy of scale and leave no one out. So then we're creating a shore, and I agree we should build a bridge to that shore. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Ms. Daniels?
Good morning, Kim Daniels, SLOCIA. The thing that caught my eye in the staff report, of course, was the 2% increase in non-salary-related costs, and so I clarified with Dan before the meeting what that meant. And part of that means the contracts that we have with outside vendors. And I'm asking your board to instruct the departments to provide as much service as possible in-house, and where we have to contract out, that the contract costs not exceed this year or this next budget year what they were for this past year, at a time when employees are dealing with no salary increases and it's not looking good for next year, that private vendors should be able to increase their costs is patently unfair. And I believe that we should all be suffering equally. And so I would ask your board to give that instruction to your departments that contracting out where it has to be done, the contract costs must remain the same as they did in prior years. And I realize there's things like fuel, et cetera, that you have no control over. But where we can, that we ensure that costs remain the same so that everybody is sharing equally in this downturn. And I will say, yes, San Luis Obispo County, from the associations that SLOCIA belongs to, is indeed the envy of many, many, if not all other entities in the state, because while we have been hit, we have not been hit nearly to the same degree that a number of our sister counties have taken significant cuts in salaries, in benefits, in loss of services to their community. And so as ugly as it is, we're still in better shape than a lot of places. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Daniels. And that will close it to the public. We'll bring it back to the board. Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we should aspire to be the envy of the state. We have a lot going on in this county. We've done a lot of things right, and a lot of it has to do with a long-term vision of things. I certainly appreciate the wise counsel of our CAO and the hard work of his staff in getting us the facts we need. I think there's a hierarchy of things that we need information on, and there are unanswered questions that will become clearer as time goes on. You know, we're going to talk realignment next. A lot of unanswered questions about the long-term viability of that, the constitutional guarantee. We need to understand that. A profound effect in a structural way on our public safety side of things. But the potential change coming in 2014 to the provision of health services is perhaps bigger. And what I was advocating is to understand, I don't believe this board has had a detailed presentation of the potential changes that are coming with that. I think that the 2 years or so that we have to ponder this is not a long lead time. Again, unanswered questions as things work their way through the courts and the political process. But I think it would be helpful for us, because we have been successful in long-term planning, to at least get a vision of what might lie ahead there and match that up against the trend lines in our own provision of health care services and, based on that, understand whether there are medium-term actions that we might take that could get us to whatever the new normal is in the most efficient and with the best provision of health care services. Because, quite frankly, and Ms. Daniels alluded to it, we're the envy of the state. That doesn't mean that we're doing everything we should in terms of mental health services, drug and alcohol treatment, and even basic health care services.
Right.
We certainly could aspire to do better.
Okay, so staff direction, if I'm understanding you, Mr. Gibson, and maybe I can look at Mr. Grant to see, we'd like to have a discussion here at the board on the potential impacts of the new health laws and such as regard to the county's sense future of when we might be able to do that?
I think we can work with Mr. Hamba probably within, I don't know, a month. Somewhere in that neighborhood, 6 weeks by the time. I know they've been working on it for quite some time in terms of trying to figure out what's the best road ahead on that. So it's probably 4 to 6 weeks. We'll bring it back.
Okay.
If I may, we're targeting bringing back the priorities and board budget policies and strategies in mid-November, if possible. It'd be nice to do it prior to then or at least couple it with that so we can try to do that.
Okay, good. All right, with that direction, I think we have a good report and ready to receive and file, voice vote, to receive and file. All those in favor say
second.
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, we've received and filed. We're going to take a 15-minute break and come back with realignment. Thank you.
Yeah. We will come back realigned.
Yeah. We are back. Madam Clerk, could you be so kind as to introduce this next item?
A2, submittal of the 2011 Public Safety Realignment Act, AB 109, Implementation Plan for consideration and approval.
Thank you. Mr. Grant.
Yes, thank you very much. We do have a PowerPoint presentation that we'll start out with right now, and if we'll click onto that, there we go. So this next item is AB 109 and AB 117. It's regarding the Public Safety Realignment Implementation Plan. This is something that came to be this year where, again, the state is handing over some of the responsibilities they used to do to the counties, all counties, not just San Luis Obispo. So what is happening is that there has been a committee of the Community Corrections Partnership, of which we'll show who is involved with that in just a moment, to develop a plan to move forward with this. That plan is before your board today and is going to be discussed in just a few moments. So it shifts certain responsibility for certain felony offenders to counties, and the state funding source is realigned for many programs in public safety, mental health, and social services. Now, we're going to focus on the public safety part of it today. Mental health and social services, there were some changes in the realignment area there, but those aren't of our concern today. They'll be discussed later on. The way it's paid for is that the state did dedicate a portion of state sales tax and a vehicle license fee for the purpose of realignment. But as we talked earlier today, this is a one-year funding right at the moment. There is no guaranteed funding for next year or in future years, and that is of great concern to all counties, including ourselves. Next slide, please. Again, the realignment summary here. On the left, for the 2011-12, those are all the programs that were affected by realignment. I won't read all through those, but we are going to focus on the lower-level offenders and parole violators and realignment of adult parole. So right there is highlighted in yellow. Those are what we're going to focus on today. Next year, if you go back one just from there. There's also another realignment, too, which is being discussed right now, and that does have to do with mental health managed care and some early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment programs. That is really up in the air right now, whether or not the state's going to move forward with that. I think that there's so much discussion now on this realignment one portion of it where we're looking at public safety realignment, that all focus is on that, and whether or not we actually get to the realignment two is being debated right now, and my speculation is probably not at this point in time. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jim Salio, Chief Probation Officer, who's going to discuss the actual plan itself.
Good morning, Jim Salio, Chief Probation Officer. The realignment plan is required by the Penal Code. That was in AB 109. It established a community correction partnership that was to vote on the plan, executive committee of that community correction partnership. Our local county process was to develop a working group to develop the plan and as a draft form and submit that to the executive committee. The executive committee did meet and vote on the plan on September 15, 2011. The working group was a broad group made up of different organizations that touch the criminal justice system in the county of San Luis Obispo. It was quite a process. They met weekly to develop the plan, and the plan is a result of their hard work. The members of the executive board, as prescribed by statute, are listed on the PowerPoint. I won't read through them all, but this was actually the voting group. The main goal of our realignment plan was to maintain our public safety in the county and improve offender success rate by reducing recidivism and increase incarceration alternatives and other treatment support for low-level offenders in our county. To do this, we developed three different strategies. One was to increase our jail capacity for the realigned population, also to increase supervision capacity to handle the realigned parole population, and finally, to increase treatment opportunities for offenders in San Luis Obispo County. And I'm going to have Sheriff Parkinson talk about realignment to custody.
Sheriff?
Good morning. The realignment population shift is estimated to be about a total of 140, but by June of 2012, it's estimated to be about 84 commitments to custody. Just to kind of give you a little update, realignment took effect last week. As of the end of last week, we had 7 already committed to county jail through realignment. I think the total estimate for the month of October was 9. So it's going to be interesting to track that as we go. We're paying particular attention to that, the length of stay, the sentence, et cetera. So we'll update you as we go. In order to prepare for realignment, I think we took a very, good approach to deciding where the monies went and what our focus was. And I think part of it is obviously to the housing. What we're doing is we're getting 2 of our modular units that were used to handle the building of the men's jail back in the 90s and getting them up to standard now to house both female on one half. And the second half is we're putting up some temporary walls, per se, to allow us the opportunity to do some counseling services and some programming that you'll hear about a little bit later. But it's something that does not exist right now in the female jail. And then on the male side, we'll be doing some double bunking to increase the capacity there. We also have the ability to increase beyond that with further staffing as a kind of a fail-safe alternative. Regarding staffing, of course, as we increase the population, we have to increase staffing because we're responsible for the safety and welfare of every inmate that's in custody. So we'll be adding 15 correctional deputies, 1 correctional sergeant, and 1 cook. We'll also be there will be an increase in the nursing hours and mental health services with the increase of 1 mental health therapist, which I really just wanted to mention as a highlight. Extremely important. We have 3 therapists assigned to the jail now. They see on average of over 100 a week. So a significant number of patients. So the increase is certainly needed. And then we'll be creating a sliding scale for our home detention program, which currently exists, but we'll be expanding and allowing some others to participate that could not afford to.
Okay. Thank you.
As I mentioned, our second strategy will be to increase our supervision capacity for the realigned parole population known as post-release community supervision. The probation department expects to be supervising up to 171 new offenders by the end of this fiscal year. In order to do this, we will be requesting 3 additional probation officers, 1 supervising probation officer who will supervise our newly created post-release community supervision unit and clerical support. We will be keeping our supervision ratios at 50-1, which is equal to the ratios we have set for our high and medium risk offenders currently on probation. We will also be increasing our electronic monitoring capabilities as an additional tool to supervise these offenders. Another strategy that we'll be working on implementing will be a pre-trial release program. This still needs to be developed, and we'll be working closely with the court, the district attorney, and the sheriff's department to develop this program. The main purpose of this program will be to give the court an option to release offenders prior to sentencing on a supervised release program. The idea would be that this strategy will help reduce overcrowding in the jail, and these offenders would be then supervised in the community by two additional probation officers. So the last strategy we'll be working on is our increased treatment capacity. So we have collaborative reentry day reporting, jail treatment, community-based drug and alcohol treatment, increased community-based cognitive behavioral treatment, and increased sober living beds. Dr. Baylor, Director of Mental Health, will talk about the collaborative reentry program.
Dr. Baylor?
Hi, Karen Baylor, Behavioral Health Administrator. This was a really interesting process to be a part of the work group and to really talk about effective strategies for this population out in the community and to provide some treatment within the jail. So we came up with this collaborative reentry program, which is geared to help offenders back into the community. We have a very successful program on the mental health side, which I've talked about before in here, where we do a reach into the jail before someone is released and find out what kind of needs they're going to need in the community. We'll even come pick them up the day that they are being released in case they don't have transportation. We help them find housing, try to get them reintegrated back into the community, and help them with making their first appointment at mental health. And so because this program has been so successful, we modeled the collaborative reentry program to be similar to that. We'll do a whole needs assessment and case plan and look at that warm handoff from being in a very structured jail environment to out in the community. We're asking for two drug and alcohol specialists, one that would be housed in the jail and one that will work out in the community. And then we want to pair this person with a case manager from CAPSLO. We're realizing out in the community that a lot of these folks are, a lot of the parolees who've been released end up at Prado, and so it seemed like a natural fit to have a new case manager who really has the knowledge and expertise in finding housing, helping these people get on benefits if they qualify. And so we'll pair the drug and alcohol specialist with the CAPSLO case manager. Jim.
Another strategy will be, treatment strategy we will be implementing will be a day reporting service center. This is a model that's been used widely in other counties. It will be a contracted program. The program will be a one-stop shop for offenders. It'll be used as not only as a sanction by the courts in lieu of sentencing to jail perhaps, but it'll also be used as a sanction by probation as a response to violations. The day reporting centers will allow offenders to receive treatment, get job skill training, and any other services that we think are going to be needed. This will be a resource to the offender population to help them successfully navigate their period of supervision.
The third part of this, you've heard about the collaborative reentry, the day reporting, now the jail treatment program, also contract services. It may be court-ordered, and this is something that I'll just highlight that we really want to work toward, rather than inmates sitting in their bunks all day, that they're actually working towards something that will help keep them out. So I think that's important to note. We'll include treatment, vocational, and educational services, and we can service up to 50 inmates per month with this program.
Another treatment intervention that we'll be using will be to expand our community-based cognitive behavioral treatment. This is a program now that the probation department is currently using where offenders are assigned to complete a treatment course that is evidence-based, that targets the criminogenic factors, and have a set specific time period that they need to expand these or attend these classes. This is something that's we've started just this year. We'll be able to increase the number of offenders we're able to serve through this program. And again, the research shows that this is really the best modality for changing offender behavior if you're targeting the right population with the right dosage.
So a number of these offenders, in fact, a significant percentage have substance abuse issues, and so we focus more on that within the community-based environment, and so we will use an evidence-based curriculum to work with these folks. It will be a partnership between probation and a drug and alcohol specialist. We'll provide the services in an outpatient setting. We'll provide some case management and do some drug testing. The next slide, please, is to increase the number of sober living bed days. And so this will reduce our reliance on out-of-county beds. We will use in-county beds, and drug and alcohol will pay for the first 4 weeks of these beds, hoping that folks will be able to participate and pay for their beds in future use because of getting a job.
So these are the strategies that we'll be implementing to successfully carry out the realignment. To do this, we're going to need 17 new positions for the Sheriff's Department, 7 new positions for the Probation Department, and 4 new positions for the Health Agency. The funding for this year...
Mr. Sarah, could we just go back to that slide
absolutely.
Real quickly? On the health agency, 4 new positions reflected, I think, on table 1. Is that also include the case management that position that which would not be a county position?
No, it does not. It includes 2 drug and alcohol therapists for the collaborative reentry program, 1 drug and alcohol therapist for increased drug and alcohol treatment in the community, and 1 mental health therapist at the jail.
Okay. So where does the outside case management position?
We didn't count that. These are county FTEs.
County FTEs.
Yes.
Okay. And that is reflected, though. That's budgeted for, though.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
So the funding for our first year, which began October 1st, we were allocated $2.2 million for this fiscal year, and then a one-time implementation funding of $155,000. So that's how much we have to spend for this first year. Annualized, our program would actually, this breakdown is about $1.5 million for housing for offenders at the jail, about $400,000 for supervision, and about another $450,000 for treatment. We have $19,000 that we had not come up with allocated funds for. The annualized expenditures for the same program to carry this on for next fiscal year and to keep all the same services intact is about $4 million. And this, again, is not guaranteed for next fiscal year. But this is what our annualized cost would be. The future funding allocation is for, again, for housing, supervision, and treatment, and it's based upon the current formula, which is 0.6211% of the total state allocation for the county of San Luis Obispo. So based upon Department of Finance projections from savings from the California Department of Corrections, who will realize savings by realignment, the allocations for San Luis Obispo County through the next 3 fiscal years, you can see what those numbers are. Again, not guaranteed, but these were the base projections that counties are working off of as they build their sustainability and their realignment plans. So again, the State Department of Finance does show an increase in funding in fiscal year 12-13. The increase in funding is primarily from the realized savings by Department of Corrections that they will have for having less people to supervise and then less prisoners in prison. Any incremental funding increase in the future, the CCP, our Community Correction Partnership, will allocate for increased treatment capacity, and all funding will be outcome-driven and based on program success. So we will be monitoring the success of our programs as we move forward. And Governor Brown has stated publicly that he will be seeking a constitutional amendment for the November 2012 ballot to make this money permanent, pass through from the controller's office to the counties directly and not be part of the general fund. So as we move forward into the future, the CCP will continue to meet monthly to evaluate the plan and make adjustments as needed. We know this is an ongoing process. What we think we need today may not be exactly what we need tomorrow, and we need to be able to adjust as we move forward. And again, like anything else, cooperation and integration will be the key to our success. I have to tell you that all departments participating, there was great collaboration, great willing to walk in the other person's shoes to see what the other person's needs are, and that we're all committed to making this successful. So therefore, it's recommended to the Board of Supervisors that the 2011 Public Safety Realignment Plan be accepted, and that direct staff to return to the board with our budget adjustments and our position allocation list changes in the future. And that concludes the presentation.
Mr. Salio, well, thank you very much, and Sheriff and Dr. Baylor, too. We have several board questions, but one that I just wanted to get to because I was holding off on it. The increased funding that we would need year over year is based on new commitments, new offenders in probation, et cetera, in terms of our needs beyond the funding for this year?
No, the funding for next year is just the annualized amount. So it's just the same program we're running this year, but annualized over 12 months instead of 9 months.
And do we have any sense of that projecting to, for instance, as I've spoken with you and the sheriff and others who've been involved in putting together this good program, do we, if the miraculous happens and the state provides all the funding that we need to make realignment work, and all of our public safety folks seem to think that this is something that should be realigned, that you can make it work well, do we have any anticipation of there being reduced? I guess it's hard to project, but the outcomes ultimately should be reduced recidivism, reduced number of people that we are having to house in jails, reduced number of people that your department's having to supervise in probation. I mean, is there any sense of how long it would take? I mean, I know all this is dependent on having the proper funding, which in this state is, you know, a very hazardous thing to project out on. But
right. The estimates from the California Department of Corrections are projected through the year 13-14. So theoretically, if we are doing our job correctly and reducing recidivism like we say we're going to, then there should be less people being committed to county jail, and thus a reduction in the need for more county jail space. The other piece, too, is the post-release community supervision population will eventually go down in that population will not be sent to prison anymore, that they'll be sent locally. So once that population essentially clears out of prison, there'll be not quite as many to be supervised. So that population should go down in the future as well.
So essentially, as money comes in, you do foresee measuring the effectiveness of the program based on the reduced recidivism, the reduced number of people being housed, et cetera.
Yes, those will be outcomes that we'll be looking at as our recidivism rate for the post-release community supervision population, the number of violations going into jail, the number of parole violations going into jail, so we can see what that's doing to the capacity. So those will be ongoing benchmarks that we'll be looking at as we move forward.
Great. We have several questions here. So Supervisor Patterson first.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Salio and members of your team, excellent job. Looks good. I'm actually enthusiastic about the idea of realignment. We know the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation has not been successful, at least in the rehabilitation portion, and I think we have a much greater chance of being successful in that area than they do. We can be more focused and deal with a smaller population and hopefully act earlier. So I'm enthusiastic about it, especially after this very comprehensive plan that you all have developed. A couple of quick questions. You mentioned the membership of the Community Correction Partnership was established by legislation, and that you have this team of voting members. During your meetings to create this plan, did you have other participants besides those that were required by the act itself?
Yes, the work group was just a working group of criminal justice professionals or people that worked with this population in the county. So there was a wide variety of different people that were there at the working group. But then the actual CCP executive board, the vote on the plan was the board as prescribed by code.
I see. And you mentioned in the Day Reporting Service Center a couple of the programs that you want to set up. You're going to contract those services out,
yes.
I assume, rather than creating that service locally with local people, or are these contractors already in existence and are they local, or are you going to be doing a request for proposals to actually provide those services? How's that going to work?
For the Day Reporting Center, the plan is to do a request for proposal. There are a couple companies right now in the state of California that are providing those same services to other counties, so we will be looking at which entity can provide the best services at the best price for us. But we think the contracting out makes it much more cost effective to do it that way.
And you think the service will be comparable? They'll provide the services?
Absolutely. They have a very good track record. They have proven programs that they've worked on. They have the ability to hire and maintain quality staff to run those programs. So we think that that's the most efficient way to do it.
And does that hold true? Sheriff Parkinson also mentioned the potential to contract out the services for the jail treatment program. Will that be a similar scenario?
I could have let you answer that. Yes. Yes, it's a similar scenario. I don't know. Maybe Chief Salio has the answer to this. I don't know if they actually hire local people from those companies or not. So, but I do know that what's extremely important to us is that we have success. And bringing in somebody with a true tested model was pretty important to us in those areas.
Very good. Thank you. And one final question. I'm curious about the annualized cost that you estimate for year two is a little over $4 million yet. The state formula would, assuming we get the money, and Governor Brown assures us that we will, estimates
Sacramento until he gets it done, right?
The formula-based calculation would bring in $5.1 million.
Correct.
How would you manage that $1 million difference, roughly?
Well, as a committee, we've agreed that future allocations that we have not funding for, or future needs that we are not funded right now, such as treatment needs, will be funded with those allocations. So we're really trying to commit to increasing treatment needs. There were other treatment ideas that came up in the working group that we just didn't have enough funding to do. So I think in the future, things that we'll need to look at are like housing and those kind of issues to provide some stability for people that are transitioning from prison back into the community, those kind of things. So we'll be definitely looking at how those funds will be best allocated to fit into our plan, keeping our goals in mind.
Great.
Can I just add one thing to that? I agree with what Chief Salio said, that that's where our commitment is for the group, but there's a lot of unknowns here. We're moving into new water here, and I think figuring out what realignment really is going to look like moving forward is going to be what we're going to be doing over the next you know, 8 to 9 months. And so hopefully we get to that point where we can dedicate that money toward treatment to reduce the recidivism rate. But the truth is I think over this evaluation period, we're going to learn a lot.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Meacham?
Jim, thank you for your report. And I know this wasn't an easy effort. the 17 full-time positions, is the funding for this provided, providing for the benefits package that goes along with these?
Yes.
Okay, good. And then I guess kind of taking off from Supervisor Gibson's comment this morning regarding mental health and the health agency, stuff like that, if we don't get success from the state and we find ourselves in kind of a precarious position in terms of ongoing requirements, I think it would be really helpful for the board to get some numbers together so that I think we already have some of that in place, because that's going to definitely affect our budget overall.
In terms of whether we get the dollars?
If we don't get the money, or if we don't get the full amount, and if we're going to continue with the level that we're talking about here, how are we going to cover that?
Yeah, we're in a very precarious position at this point in time. We do have the one-year funding. We have no funding guaranteed after that. So if we didn't get the $4 million, we are stuck with a program that would be hard to unwind at that time and hand back, because, remember, this is state legislation that now has transferred this responsibility to counties without an adequate funding source in the out years. So it's something that every county is very concerned about. And the meeting with the governor that he had with the LA Board of Supervisors, this was the top topic in play. And there's also some discussion about whether or not the big counties are going to make a play for additional dollars more than what they have now. So not only would it be a fight with the state, it might be some infighting between counties in terms of the allocation.
Well, that's what concerns me, is that some of the big guys can kind of push their weight around a little bit and get a little bit more of the funding, and then that creates a little bit of a deficit for us. And so if we don't get full funding for this and we continue along with this program, that's a discussion that we're going to have to
absolutely
hard and strong at.
We are very concerned about it, and we've got our eye on it, definitely.
Absolutely.
Okay. Mr. Gibson?
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, this is an exciting opportunity, but I think the excitement comes half from the nervousness of looking at the future and half from the potential of doing something really, really good. Let me first thank you, Mr. Salio, and all that participated in your committee. I understand you came very close to consensus on this, and that, given the complexities involved here, is a real accomplishment, and I appreciate it. I am heartened to hear that the vision is to move more resources toward the treatment side. I think that's obvious to a lot of people that deal with these kinds of issues, that there's not only cost effectiveness, but, you know, a humanitarian component that makes a lot of sense in doing that. And I understand that that we are weighted a little more heavily toward the housing side, the incarceration side, in this first year. We can't make this transition simply. It's profound. But I really do hope to hear that we're moving toward treatment, and I'm looking very much forward to the performance measures that Supervisor Hill was asking about. I was going to turn around and demand those performance measures, because obviously that's where we go. Question to Mr. Grant. The funding formula at a little over 0.6% of the total statewide is under discussion. And if I remember correctly, the original funding formula was set with a negotiation that involved CSAC and the CAOs and things like that. Is it a similar kind of venue where that discussion is going to take place should the formula be changed?
Well, it really hasn't been discussed at this point, but yes, I believe that would absolutely be imperative that we get together with CSAC and the other counties.
I would certainly hope so. Among the diversities in the state are the diversities in sizes of counties, from 12 million to 1,200 population, and the little counties, and we're sort of in the middle. So, I'm not sure exactly how that plays out. A couple of more specific questions on the plan, the jail treatment program, and reading the write-up of that, a wide range of potential services. How are we going to narrow down exactly what's going to be provided? I mean, it's everything from mental health and substance abuse to job training, and I'm not looking at the table here to know how many dollars are proposed to be spent on that, But is that are we going to put out some guidelines about that from your committee, or are we going to wait for RFPs to come back? How are we going to
do that? Well, the jail treatment is actually going to go into the sheriff's budget, so I'll let Sheriff Parkinson
explain
how he's going to do that.
Oh, I see.
Well,
successful handoff.
So what's
actually what you saw is a combination of programs, because it really is a combination. You know, we talked about the increase in mental health services. We talked about the contract services coming in and focused on programs, and then I think you'd mentioned the job skill training or something to that effect. That's something we've been working on since I took office. I mean, it's something that we've talked about, and we've dedicated one of our custody lieutenants to be the last 6 months working on. So that is a program that fits into the big scheme of things. So in a sense, realignment came along, and it provided something that we didn't have. We didn't have the ability to provide, but we're grouping all those different process together. In regards to specifically the treatment and what contract, I think we'll kind of vet that out as we move on. I don't have too much detail, but we certainly are going to provide that detail to you as we go forward. But what you're discussing or asking about is multiple programs all being brought into one.
Right. I mean, it'd be nice to have an assessment of need. You know, do we need more mental health services, or do we need more job skill services? And how you split up that piece of the pie is important, I think.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And I think that's some of the process we're going through. It's going to take a while to really, you know, figure out what is most effective. And I think talking about those measures and measures that Chief Salio is you know, kind of insisted on from the very beginning, which, you know, I think we are all in support of, I think will help guide us into the future of where we're going and where we're putting our resources and directing our money.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Jumping on a couple other specifics. One of them is again under treatment, the expanded sober living environment. They're talking about 24 new beds. There's a mere $48,000 budgeted there. So a couple of questions. First of all, do those beds exist?
And yes, this is expanding bed days.
Okay. So, and $2,000 per bed pays for
45 offenders.
45 offenders
for four weeks,
and that math works out. So that sounds pretty cost effective. Do we have any evidence on 4 weeks of sober living as a
The goal is that we would pay for the first 4 weeks, but the goal would be that if the person needs to stay there longer, that they are getting other resources out in the community, that they're finding a job, and they're going to be able to contribute to that and then eventually find their own housing.
Okay.
So it's part of that transition from the jail into the community and to stabilize them so that they are successful.
Okay, so I'd be interested in tracking that again.
Absolutely.
In terms of four weeks. Do we need to shift that one way or the other? And then finally, the pretrial services program. It sounds like a Mr. Salio kind of thing. In reading this, I guess I'm interested in how those services relate to an older concept called bail, which was one of those things that we used to try to assure people would get to court on time.
Right. Well, it does allow the court to release people on their own recognizance or reduce bail,
okay,
with the assurance that somebody's going to be supervising them and monitoring that they're getting to court. So that program is pretty much measured by the success rate of showing back up for court and being there at court.
Okay. And the goals of that are to get people back to court? I mean, I guess what's the goal of that? We're not offering treatment, I don't think.
No, the goal of that, it's a safety net for the jail to help reduce jail bed days.
Okay.
So the idea would be that we know there's a possibility that we're going to get more people sentenced to jail under realignment,
right,
than the capacity we have at the jail. So we have to be creative in how we find other alternatives to people rather than being in jail. So this offers one other solution, and it's a model that's used in quite a few counties. Most counties that have jail caps use a pretrial release program.
So we have evidence as to its effectiveness.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Hill. My question, Chief Sally, and again, thank you for the work that you've done along with Ms. Baylor and Sheriff Parkinson, is a restitution. While we've got these people incarcerated, is there going to be any work programs for them involved? I see the training and the vocational and the education, but something along the work-related program where they would be able to earn money and possibly pay for part of this while they're on electronic monitor. They could be out in the community doing things and that sort of thing.
Right.
No, you can start.
Well, the people that are out on electronic monitoring, the idea would be that they'd be working, and that would be one of the reasons that they would get out on electronic monitoring. But to have a work release program where they're providing community service back to the community, filling potholes, doing cleanup in the community, those kind of things, those are things I think that the sheriff can speak
to. And electronic monitoring is paid for by the offender, am I correct?
That's correct. It's offender paid.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's one of the programs we're expanding, and we're going to offer some multi-tier costs for people that obviously don't get paid enough to be able to afford electronic monitoring because, A, we keep them employed, and B, there is some form of ability to pay restitution. As far as in-custody programs, we're pretty limited on what they can do to earn money. One of the things we're exploring right now, we're working with I'm working with state sheriffs and also with Rob Lewin, the fire chief, and that is fire camp. We are unique. There's only two fire camps like ours in the state. Cuesta Camp is a non-housed camp. Most of all the other ones, the inmates are sent to the camp. They sleep and live there. Our camp is not. They transport them across the street from CMC. So we're working with the state in order to try to keep that camp alive, because most of the offenders that they use for that camp on the state level are the ones that I'll be receiving. So we're working on that. If that does go through, there is a mechanism to pay them, be it very, very, very little. But that's the only program that I can think of that would be in custody to help rescue.
Will they continue with their work at the animal control in those other county facilities?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's part of the job skill training that we're looking at, teaching them something not only to be productive, but also something that they can use that skill when they get out to seek a job in that area.
Is there a plan with the cities and the other municipalities, since we'll be taking their prisoners also, to work on a program with them where they would go back, like to Pismo, and do a program for them or work within the city or Arroyo or Grover or one of those?
I guess the answer is no. Right now, currently, we do send inmates to any city requesting for services. The question is supervision. For them, can they do it? Is it economical for them to supervise those inmates when they take them? Some departments take them on a regular basis. The challenge for us is if we're going to take them out in the community, which I think is a great plan, is supervision, and supervision costs money because we have to hire bodies to do it. We just don't have that excess of bodies to send them with those work crews. So we'll expand it as much as we can, or we will continue to offer it whenever we can.
Is there a possibility of volunteer supervision within the communities?
That would be very questionable.
Right.
Unless you're volunteering.
But be happy to.
I think I'm a gun.
More than one. Thank you.
Mr. Meacham?
Okay, this is probably a real silly question, but the $2.3 million, do we have that in the bank or is the check in the mail?
The check's in the mail, but that money, though, it's been assured by the governor's office that actually the way the state budget is constructed, that money is guaranteed, that actually if there was a reduction in the VLF, for instance, that other funding would come to pay for this, but this in the governor's budget for this fiscal year, that money is guaranteed to the counties.
Okay. I just watch our back, guys.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Salia. Well, I hope, I do hope that our assemblyman and state senator see the great need to fund this program, I guess, as we'll continue to lobby him, and that would be for all of our legislature, too, because, quite frankly, in terms of the way I look at this, this really can be quite a benefit to our community. I think that we can deliver these services more effectively, and I think that we can intervene and help to rehabilitate people much more effectively and, get them back into the community and not see them in our jails. And I hope that the money continues to come in, because I think that I think that your team will have other partnerships to form with some of our, whether it be contracted or some of the groups that already provide services. businesses. I'm glad we're going to do some more drug and alcohol, definitely needed for the folks that end up in trouble. Case management, definitely needed for the folks that end up in trouble. So those are the kinds of things that we want to be able to deliver. Mm-hmm. So with that, I have no request to speak unless somebody's coming forward. So I will close it to the public and bring it back to the board.
Well, I move approval of the Public Safety Realignment Implementation Plan and ask staff to return to the board with the necessary position allocations to implement the plan.
Second. Okay. Moved by Supervisor Patterson, seconded by Supervisor Meacham. We are grateful for the law enforcement professionals that have worked on this plan, and we will stay engaged as we always do as things move forward. With that, Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes. Thank you. And with that, we come to our closed session. I open it to the public. There is no request to speak, no one coming forward, so I'll close it to the public. And Mr. Jensen, a time estimate?
About 20 minutes.
Perfect. All right. We will recess until 1:30.
Thanks.
No, we did all.
You're live.
All right. Welcome back to the Board of Supervisors. And before we get into the afternoon items, Mr. Jensen, any report out of closed session?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The board met in closed session. No reportable action was taken.
Thank you. I appreciate that. All right. We have before us some planning department items. So if you would be so kind, Madam Clerk, to introduce the first one.
A3, study session on the general plan annual progress report for fiscal year 2010-11.
Thank you. And I see Ms. Griffin. We've been shot into space or something. Okay. If you're listening at home, do not be afraid. We have technical assistance rushing our way.
Start speaking like a pilot.
Okay. We are, we're smoothing it out. It's the turbulence is being mastered, and we're okay. And so just have your peanuts and your Diet Cokes and watch the movie. And, wow, we're changing microphones. She's really doing this fast, too. This is exciting. Only you could see this on the radio. All right. Are we ready now?
I think so.
All right. Emmy, take it away, so to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board.
Thank you, Jamie.
Jamie Lopes with Long Run Planning. I think this is on. I'll talk a little louder.
Okay.
Well, today we're just going to take a look at last year's activity and planning and look at the general plan a bit. Just looking at what was accomplished last year, the economic strategy was endorsed by your board. The project was, of course, done by the Economic Vitality Corporation. The Paso Robles Groundwater Basin Resource Capacity Study was approved in February. Your board also looked at the process improvement committees and their work for permit streamlining. And that work was approved and moving ahead now. These projects are basic projects that implement policies in the county general plan. And as I go through these, if you have any questions of where they're from or what they're about, please interject. Our housing division issued $1.4 million in home grants for affordable housing projects and ordinances to include emergency shelters, transitional and supportive housing were adopted by your board. The permit streamlining, and what we're looking at now are some board priorities that were set in March this year for completion this fiscal year. The first being the Permit Streamlining Incentives Project. I just mentioned that was approved and is now going into implementation. The Energy Wise or Climate Action Plan is in hearings at the Planning Commission. I think the next is October 13th this week. The Economic Strategy, endorsed by your board. Plan Development Ordinance is a project that is being drafted. And the Agricultural Cluster Ordinance is a draft with an EIR. It's available. Other board priorities for this fiscal year, the land use and circulation element. Your board divided the project into two. Phase one will be starting this fall and will be out for review next year. The Los Osos Habitat Conservation Plan is still underway and pending. Again, the Paso Robles Groundwater Basin RCS was approved. Special Events Ordinance is in hearings, as well as the Shandon Community Plan. Other activities that have to do with the general plan implementation are revisions to the Resource Management System and Growth Management Ordinance are beginning this fall. Those will come out next year as well. The Los Osos Retrofit Program has been going on for several years as an implementation of a resource capacity study for the groundwater basin there. James Caruso will talk a bit about that in a minute. The Infill Subdivision and Development Standards is a project to promote infill development within our communities and remove obstacles to that development in our ordinance. So that's a project that will go forward with the consultant. The Capital Improvement Program Committee has formed and is actively working on infrastructure prioritizing for the five-year rolling capital improvement program. James Caruso will talk a bit about the Los Osos Retrofit Program just to identify some things about it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lopes. James Caruso, Senior Planner, Department of Planning and Building. So a few years ago, your board instituted a couple of ordinances in the Los Osos Groundwater Basin. These ordinances were a Title VIII retrofit upon sale, or plumbing fixture retrofit upon sale ordinance, and then an ordinance amendment to Title 19, the building and construction ordinance requiring certain things to be done before a building permit can be issued in Los Osos, which included retrofitting enough houses to set aside twice the amount of water that the new house was going to use. So a little bit of information on what we've got since 2008, about August, I think, is when we took in our first retrofit form. We've got about 332 retrofit forms, might be a couple of more now. Not all of those retrofit forms represent houses that, of course, needed to be retrofitted. Some of those houses already met the requirements, but because the program required some type of proof, we have those retrofit forms from all of those houses. We've only issued 9 certificates from people who have submitted enough retrofit forms to show they've saved twice the amount of water, which is about 900 gallons, which is quite a bit of water, by the way. Those 9 water savings certificates that we've issued for Title 19, there is actually 2 building permits have been issued. And when you add up the retrofitted addresses, we're estimated about 12 to 15 acre feet a year have been saved. Now, on the other side, we did a little exercise, and I have to thank the Los Osos Community Services District. Getting this type of data is very intense, but they showed a lot of cooperation, so we have to say thank you to them. We took a sampling of 50 addresses and they were all in the CSD area, and they were all retrofitted because we wanted to see how much water a retrofitted retrofitted residences actually saved. So when we gave the CSD the date that each of these addresses was retrofitted, they looked a year before, a year after. And we came up with aggregate, we came up with a 28.6% reduction in water use from those 50 addresses. Now, sounds pretty good, doesn't it? We have to walk that back a little bit. First off, we've noticed that there were a bunch of what we call outliers. There were houses that were using no water before they were retrofitted, and then after they were retrofitted was using a lot of water. The theory was that those were houses that were perhaps in foreclosure, were empty, they were sold, therefore they were retrofitted, and that's why they landed on the retrofitted list. The year after, people are living there, and it could be a family living there with a lot of people. So there were a lot of outliers. The other thing that the CSD calculated for us is during that time, 08 to 2011, and these are calendar years, overall community demand was reduced by about 15% over that time. So while our aggregate savings on retrofitted sites was 28.6, overall we had a 15% savings. So somewhere in there, those numbers, of course, are integrated. So we can't really say how much water exactly was saved by the retrofit program. But you can see it was quite a bit more than the overall community reduction. And that was going to conclude our comments on this program.
Okay. Thank you, James.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the housing element and the progress we've made in the program, the five-year program that the element is in, the housing element or plan has these five-year programs, and that's important to consider in this particular slide. In this last fiscal year, 19 affordable units were completed. That was down from 78 that were completed in the previous fiscal year. Looking at the previous five-year time frame for the housing element, 2004 to 2009, the county reached 57% of its five-year goal for affordable housing. At this time, in this current five-year cycle from 2009 to 2014, we're now at 7.8% of our five-year goal. So we have a lot of catch-up to do, and hopefully the economy will come back and help us do that. Looking at development activity then in general, for residential development, on the right side of this table, you'll see in blue that 373 housing units were completed in the fiscal year. That's down from previous years, as the table shows. Out of that total 373 units, 26 units were market rate multifamily units. So I think that tells a story. For commercial development, though, the valuation of projects that were completed last year rose quite a bit, jumped up 20% from the previous fiscal year. So that is a bright spot in terms of how the development community is still going ahead with commercial development and maybe coming back a bit earlier than residential. Looking at your Board of Supervisors hearings, and of course you're considering all kinds of requests. These are the number of hearings you've had, and as you can see, there was a 12% decrease in the last fiscal year from the previous one. You had a total of 129 hearings last year, so maybe that's a good thing. We don't know. With that, that concludes the presentation. The report can be reviewed by your board. You can consider public comments if you wish, and we ask you to receive and file the report. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie. Supervisor Patterson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lopes, under the board priorities, where we have actually the first priority, streamlining, permit streamlining, and incentives, an issue came up recently relative to the cost of permitting a photovoltaic system, and we had talked about incentivizing that, and I'm just curious to know where that is in the process. A recent survey countywide indicated that the county's permit fee for a photovoltaic system was significantly more than other jurisdictions, and I'm just curious to know where that lies in the process. And I know Ms. Journey isn't here, but hopefully, Ms. Griffin, you'll have that answer.
Yeah, Cami Griffin, County Planning. We're working on looking at reducing the cost of a PV system that's a standardized system, so something that's rooftop using approved inverters and approved batteries, and a system that is not unique. So if you can use all of those standardized ways of doing PV, then the plan check is very simple. So, for instance, earlier this year, your board granted a fee waiver to Grid Alternatives, and we're going to look into what their system is. They're going to provide us the information on it, and for those systems, we should be able to offer a reduced price because they use the same system over and over again. What we're finding with our PV systems is that's kind of unique right now. The technology is changing so quickly that we see new inverters coming in, new ways of doing things, and so when you have something like that, it does need to be reviewed to make sure that it meets the electrical code and we aren't having any kind of issues or problems. But where we can create that standardized system with those pieces of the system that have all been checked, then we'll be able to offer a reduced cost.
Well, what I'm curious to know, I'm assuming that all jurisdictions are faced with that same moving technology, if you will, and yet some jurisdictions the permit fee is significantly less than what we're charging. Can one assume then that the additional cost for their review is being absorbed elsewhere in their budget, or how is that handled?
Yeah, it's either being, you know, I'm not certain how the other jurisdictions do it, so it's either being subsidized in some way, or they have those reduced fees for these stock-type systems. It's hard to know, you know, what individual jurisdictions are doing.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you. Cammy, one of the things that I'm going to go over to page A315, promoting infill and removing obstacles to strategic growth. One of the things that's very difficult for people to accomplish is if they want to do a granny quarters, for example, and the road fees that are accompanied to that, some of the secondary units. So I don't know how we get into the discussion about that, at what point we can evaluate these sorts of things, but it seems counter to trying to get infill by the cost going up so much relative to some of the fees.
You know, the road fees are a public works item, and I'm not certain exactly how they charge those on secondary dwellings, but I think if it's a full residence, it's not a guest house, they consider it a residence and they charge full road fees. That's something we can bring back to the Public Works Department for a discussion that they might want to have with you later. And we did pass ordinances that allow those fees to be deferred until final building inspection instead of at time of permit.
Right.
And for years, we also had stock secondary dwelling unit plans that were available to folks. Unfortunately, we've had so many building code changes over the last few years that they haven't kept up. And we're really looking for someone, hopefully, to come forward and modify those plans as necessary so they meet current codes.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Further questions from the board before we go to the public? Not right this moment. Okay. On A31 request, Mr. Greening, please.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and I appreciate the report. It was well laid out and quite informative. A couple of questions. On the rural area plan, will there be a localized public process? Obviously, we are replacing localized plans that centered around communities in specific areas of the county with much broader areas, particularly in the inland regions, very large areas. Will there still be some sort of community-based localized public process where members of different communities can speak to each other and kind of form their village? And I realize it's kind of awkward because we're not doing the actual communities. We're doing the Swiss cheese around the holes. So it's not always that easy to get people together in the Swiss cheese and miss the holes. But as you know, that's been sort of a critique of the sequence of events as it's laid out right now. And I guess the critique, or at least the skepticism, remains. Since we're doing that, the skepticism remains. But I hope we can constructively engage in ways to make it work better. Relative to the resource management system, the Planning Commission this week will be considering an action to forward to your board to reduce the frequency from annual to biannual. They are not considering other possibilities you have discussed, such as including the cities and perhaps moving some or all of the responsibility to SLOCOG and or changing the categories reviewed. And so I'm wondering if that's going to pick up when you get it from the Planning Commission, if that's a later piece that you're going to refer to the Planning Commission and hear back. I'd hate to see the timing decision made in isolation from some of the other decisions. One of the reasons or justifications for a longer frequency is the time needed to gear up a better, more comprehensive way of doing it, and that should be kind of in the background to that decision. Relative to Mr. Meacham on the road, oh, and by the way, speaking of which, when we're talking about categories, I am going to continue to advocate that we change the roads category to transportation. If we're serious about our EnergyWise climate action plan, in which the greenhouse gas inventory found that more than two-thirds of our emissions were from transportation, we need to stop having such an auto-centric way of looking at transportation. And that gets to Meacham on the road fees. I agree that they can sometimes be oppressive. Can we figure out a way to charge them by vehicle rather than by roof overhead? A granny unit inhabited by a granny who doesn't drive anywhere shouldn't be paying the road fees of a residence that has four or five cars parked and going in and out all day. That also is a subsidy of the driver by the non-driver. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. And that's all I have on this item, so I will bring it back to the board. I think that sounds like a interesting, perhaps, TV show, Meacham on the Road Fees. Colleagues like to comment, give any further direction before we receive and file this item and move on to our priorities?
Mr. Gittin? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I always appreciate the chance to review what we've done in the last year. It tends to go by in a blur sometimes, and mm-hmm. It's nice to mark that we actually can tick a few things off the list. I look forward to the continued work, and we have a range both of working on modifying the general plan and also processing projects under the general plan. So I understand that this is required, but it's a useful compendium of progress. So if you seek a motion to receive and file, I can make that motion.
Okay. I guess we can do a voice vote on that. All in favor of receiving and filing? Say aye.
Aye.
Okay.
So this gets submitted just in the normal course of business soon to OPR?
Yep.
Okay. Very good.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it. And we see a little switch of characters. And Madam Clerk, if you could.
I'm sorry. I didn't want a follow-up question.
Yeah.
Mr. Greening had made the comment relative to the RMS. And is this going back to the Planning Commission? Is it going to be?
Mm-hmm.
How's this going to go? Because I know that we did give direction in one regard.
Yep.
I'll answer that. Mike Wilkin, planning staff. The Planning Commission will be considering an amendment to the general plan to allow the RMS annual report to be done biannually or as otherwise directed by your board, and that was your board's direction from several months ago. And I believe that is going, I think it's this Thursday, as a matter of fact, and then this will be, since it's an amendment to the general plan, it will be before your board in November for final action. And at that time, we can give your board a report on our discussions, status report on our discussions with SLOCOG to get to Mr. Greening's questions about, well, where is this in with SLOCOG and the cities, because your board was interested in having them also participate in doing kind of a county-wide resource report. So we can give a status report to your board when we're at your board in November with the amendment, the framework, which is simply an amendment to allow this this report to be done biannually.
Okay, thank you, Mike. All right, Madam Clerk, introduce the next one, please.
A4, report on the Department of Planning and Building Priorities.
All right. I see Mr. Giffen.
Good afternoon, Chairman Hill, supervisors. So we've had the retrospective look from Mr. Lope's presentation. Now what we'd like to do is do a little bit of a forecast of where we stand with our upcoming programs and priorities. So as you all know, beginning back in 2008, we began coming that...
I think she's going to point your mic a little bit or adjust it just so they can hear you better at
okay.
home.
I'll recap.
Okay.
All right. Chairman Hill, supervisors, my name is Jason Giffen, director with planning and building. You just heard the retrospective update from Mr. Lopes, and now what I'd like to do is give the forecast of where some of our programs and priorities are going over the next several months. As you know, we've been coming periodically a few times a year to give you a status report on our updates, and we've been doing that since October 2008. Mm-hmm. We were last before your board with a comprehensive update on the 29th of March of this year, and since then we've had two installments of updates on our economic programs and initiatives, both in June and September. So today, what we're going to be asking you for is direction on reaffirming our existing four guiding priorities, which we use essentially from a budget perspective to identify which programs we're going to be including in our operational plan, and also to get an update on any tweaks or changes that you would like us to make to our current list of priorities. This slide gives you a summary of the four guiding priorities that we have, the first of which is to not adversely affect paying customers, the second is to meet all legal mandates, and the third is to forward the goals of AB 32 and SB 375, and the final, which we have been giving you frequent updates on, is to forward the goals of a county economic strategy. Before I move into a blow-by-blow on the top 10 priorities, I just want to recap how the report is set up. If you look at the appendices of the report, we have essentially four tables, the first three of which I like to call are included in our operational plan. These include, in Table 1, items which are primarily associated with applications for discretionary land use items or larger scale programs which are backed by federal dollars. They're essentially our revenue generating programs. The second are the mandated programs, that's standard requirements to update state regulations, frequent updates to our county general plan. And then the third table, which we come to you for probably the most frequent direction on, are our budgeted items, which primarily include our land use proposals and recommendations on everything ranging from general plan and ordinance amendments to new programs. The other thing I'd like to point out, we've recently expanded Table 3 to also include critical business operation and support functions, whether it be IT-related, such as the integrated document management system, or other essential accounting-type programs. I do want to point out that every time we do make a change to our priority on the existing Table 3, we have to do that commensurate with the resources and staffing that we have available. If you recall from page A-45 of the report, at the time the report was written, we mentioned that we had three vacancies currently existing, and since the recent retirement of John Kelly, that's now gone up to four vacancies out of our 90 and a quarter FTEs included on our position allocation list. So that, I just wanted to mention that to give you some perspective as we move forward with our programs, that we have to do that commensurate with the resources that we have available. Over the last year, we've looked at dramatically expanding what's called Table 4. Table 4 goes beyond what I call our operational plan, and it looks at the functional equivalent of a five-year CIP, I guess, if you will, for land use programs and other business operation improvements. We've broken it into years 3, 4, and 5, so that's fiscal year 2012-13, 13-14, and then 14-15. Included on these tables, we primarily have items which are taken from our strategic growth policies, and then the other elements which you can see on your screen there, such as the housing element, the conservation open space element, to name a few. When we have gone through with a fine-tooth comb over the county general plan, it turns out that we have about 70 high-priority items. So when we come to your board with recommendations or requests to help us set and balance those priorities, you can see why a lot of discussion needs to be had, because there's a lot of competing interests there. And once again, as we decide to move items or recommend to move items from tables from years 3, 4, and 5 on table 4 up to table 3, again, we'll only be making those recommendations considerate with the resources and staffing that we have available. So now let's focus in a little bit more on our current top 10 priorities. And as you'll see, as I go through these top 10 priorities, we're getting pretty close on almost half of them for nearing conclusion. So not so much at this planning session, but at the next one in the spring, we're going to be moving forward with most likely adding 3 or possibly 4 more new items to the priority list. So we can talk about that a little bit more as we continue. So first up, you're very familiar with the effort which was led by Supervisor Meacham to implement some streamlining efforts associated with the Process Improvement Committees. We're very near completion of all implementation, and that will be concluded at the end of the year. We have the EnergyWise Plan, formerly known as the Climate Action Plan, which is currently going through the Planning Commission with the next hearing coming up on the 13th of October. Moving along, you're all very familiar with our local efforts associated with the Economic Strategic Plan. The plan was released November of last year. Our conversations with the EVC on what we can do to forward those goals are continuing, and we have begun work to complete a draft of an update to the economic element. Another item on this list is working on putting together a plan development ordinance. That draft is still under review and as we continue to work with our stakeholders. So that one's not as far along as the previous three that I just mentioned. Moving along, updates to the Ag Cluster Subdivision Program have been completed. They are currently out for public review along with a completed draft EIR. The EIR that went along with this program was the first comprehensive EIR that we've done. Well, since I've come on board, we did do a previous in-house review when the grading ordinance updates were last done. And this signifies a significant amount of time and dedication from staff. The second item on this slide, Mr. Wolken and Mr. Lopes have already given you an update on. You're very familiar with the two-phased approach associated with the loose update. Moving on to the next slide. I don't want to prematurely rip off this Band-Aid, but you're all very familiar with the events ordinance update, which is coming back to your board on November 8th. And finally on this slide, the Shannon Community Plan has made its way through the Planning Commission after a number of very, very involved and extended discussions with the Planning Commission. We plan on bringing that to your board next month. The next two items, update on the Los Osos Habitat Conservation Plan. Our draft plan continues to be underway, and we continue to have open dialogue with both wildlife agencies, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as the Department of Fish and Game. The final item on this slide is the resource capacity study for the Paso Robles groundwater basin. You're all very familiar with that the study has in fact been completed. And what we would be asking you today is formally add the implementation measures associated with the Paso Robles resource conservation plan, resource capacity study to our top 10 list. Next, I'm going to ask Cammy to go through some specific changes that have been brought to the department's attention associated with agriculture processing for olives. Given the direction that we had at the last strategic planning update, we had to postpone
certain ag tourism amendments, which this would have included. So I'm going to ask Cammie to walk through the next few slides to give you an update as to what we're requesting today.
Thank you. So on your page A-43, about the middle of that page, there's a paragraph that talks about this issue. As Mr. Giffen mentioned, you did postpone a number of items on list three, and that was in order for us to bring the implementation of the resource capacity study up into our current workload. And included in the postponement was the remainder of the agricultural tourism amendment. So these are all the other amendments other than events that were included in ag tourism, and that includes lodging, sales, retail sales, signage, and rural recreation uses. And it also included a reevaluation of olive oil processing. That was easy for me to say. Currently, if you're in the agriculture land use category, olive oil processing is only allowed if you have 100% of the olives that you're processing grown on site. It doesn't sit within the ag processing land use definition. It actually sits within a definition called food and beverage products. And when we were looking at this, it really came down to scale. Most of our local olive oil manufacturers aren't processing at a scale of a large commercial olive oil manufacturer. The definition being within the food and beverage products definition is really a recognition of those larger commercial type processors. So the idea is that you would add a definition of what is more of a boutique processing into the definition of ag processing, and then it would be allowed within the agriculture land use category without the 100% requirement. It would also allow staff to look at adding sales and tasting, similar to what's allowed with wineries. As I said, this was a part of the whole rest of the ag tourism package that your board actually directed staff to do as a whole. That came as a request from members of the public to take the rest of ag tourism together, and this was included. But we have had a request from the olive oil industry to separate this from the rest of those amendments. And if we did that, what we would do is we would begin processing this amendment as soon as the events amendments are completed, and not pick up the rest of those items, the lodging, rural recreation, signage, and retail sales, until after we finished the olive oil, separate olive oil amendment. And so we're asking today for specific direction as part of this priority setting session.
So in conclusion, we're asking for you to reaffirm the four guiding priorities that the department has and to provide any additional changes or direction on our priority lists. The other thing that I would like to mention is, in the beginning of my presentation, I mentioned that three or four items are approaching closure on the top 10 list, so any preliminary thoughts you have on that, we'd be open and willing to hear. We've got our own idea of what we will be recommending next spring when we come back, but any preview that you may give us would be very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Giffen. Real quick before my colleagues weigh in, the PD ordinance, and I see Mr. Bunin here, and when last time I spoke with he and his members, and I think I did speak with both of you, Mr. Giffen and Ms. Griffin, where are we on that? There was some sense that perhaps we were that the committee had reached some sort of, I don't want to call it impasse, but maybe less productive part. And I think that this is something that we all appreciate as something important to meet our strategic growth principles and to be able to work together with the development community to be able to do that. So where are we and where are we going next, I guess?
Certainly, Chairman Hill. We have had discussions ongoing, which have been led by Cammie Griffin and Brian Petrotti on our side, along with Jerry and many of his members. We have been talking about making the PD ordinance have some of the flexibility that Mr. Bunin has recommended, along with his colleagues. Those discussions are still underway. It probably did temporarily stall out, but we've got meeting scheduled with Mr. Bunin, and for some more specific details, I can have Cammie respond to that since she's been a little closer to those details.
I think last time we had talked, we had also thought about maybe adding some more designer architects, folks who, you know, have had to figure out the creative ways to make things happen.
Yeah, that's correct. We did receive a letter from the Home Builders Association outlining their issues. A lot of them have to do with legal interpretation that we'll continue to have ongoing discussions with County Council. But we also are looking to expand the ad hoc group that's been looking at the PD ordinance to include some architects and designers who have used other PD ordinances in the county, the other cities who have these types of ordinances. Also, one of the issues that the county has is that a lot of the cities do it having very specific overlays. So they actually zone pieces of their towns for planned development. And we've really wanted to not go that direction and allow it to be used wherever the zoning would otherwise allow. So in residential single family and residential multifamily anywhere in the county, and really try and avoid that specific zoning. It makes sense in a city. It's a smaller jurisdiction, but mm-hmm. doesn't make as much sense in a county. So we're still working on it, and we still think we still hope we'll come to an agreement and be able to get the support of the home builders.
Okay. Let me just emphasize that I think it's important that we get on this and make it happen and start putting it into hearings because, as you know, I know it's there's not a heck of a lot happening in the planning in the development community right now, but we certainly want to have everything in place for when that does happen so that the folks can meet, you know, we can all be on the same page in terms of the goals. So with that, Supervisor Patterson and then Supervisor Meacham.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on a couple of those issues, Ms. Griffin, I do hope that you'll continue to work with the building industry on the PD ordinance. I think, as Supervisor Hill mentioned, it is a tool that will allow us to better implement the strategic growth principles. And I know the stumbling block is that overlay issue that you mentioned that allows easier implementation, if you will, in the smaller jurisdictions. And I do hope that we can find a way to implement this countywide and not have to go to specifics of plan overlays. And so I wish you luck on that and do hope that you'll continue to work expeditiously on it. Following up on the issue raised by Supervisor Meacham regarding the olive oil processing, and again, the focus here would be on the smaller growers that want to process on-site and sell on-site. And you mentioned disconnecting that from the other ag tourism issues, and that's fine, except in my mind, what that does is further delay the other ag tourism issues, which I think are very important. It's been something that, you know, we had a working group address that for a couple of years, and I know we separated the events ordinance out from that, put everything else on hold, but I do think those other ag tourism issues are important. And if you want to separate out the olive oil processing and get that done, I would support that. If we could also follow on the heels of that with the other issues in the ag tourism, because we do know, having heard from our ag community, that they need all options available to them to better support their agricultural endeavors. And I would really like to see us move forward with the other ag tourism items. And then my final question is another issue that is constraining strategic growth implementation is our infrastructure deficiencies that are countywide. And I know planning has done a considerable amount of work over the past year or so in identifying what those infrastructure deficiencies are. And while it's not on our top 10 list, I think it should be. And I know that it requires coordination with Public Works because some of those infrastructure deficiencies involve Public Works facilities like water treatment, wastewater treatment, transportation infrastructure, but it also involves resources, water, for example, and land, if you consider the zoning availability for certain types of development. That's really not infrastructure, but it is a potential impediment to strategic growth if we don't have the land zoned appropriately for housing and that sort of thing. And what I'm curious about is what is planning's thinking? I know currently Public Works is working on a countywide master water plan, which will identify our water resources countywide and speak to those issues. But is there an effort afoot to really identify what those constraints are in a very direct way? When you take a look countywide at where we have development restrictions, a large portion of the county, we can't develop there if we wanted to, even if it made good strategic growth sense, because we have some sort of infrastructure deficiency. And is there some way to focus on that, get that information back to this board so we can focus on addressing those deficiencies, both in infrastructure and resources?
Chairman Hill, Supervisor Patterson, those issues are at the forefront of a lot of the concerns that we have in the planning department. Some specific efforts that we're working on right now, one of which is related to our Sustainable Communities grant that we recently received, is that we'll be doing a community needs assessment through four primary communities: San Miguel, Napomo, Oceano, and Templeton, where, given the size of our county, we're going to be tackling this in pieces, essentially. And the needs assessment for those four communities is the first piece for us collecting a good inventory of what deficiencies exist with our various infrastructure. In addition to that, there is a internal program that we've been working on with General Services, the CAO's office, as well as Public Works, to identify deficiencies with county-run facilities. What we expect to be an offshoot of that is greater coordination with the CSDs.
Great.
As I understand, we're going to be having a report on that towards the end of the year for your board. But what we can do is we can provide, as a part of our next strategic planning session update in the spring, some feedback on where we stand with the deficiencies inventory and what are kind of our next steps that we'll be doing in association with the various programs that may not collectively solve the problem all at once, although when you put them all together, it really adds up.
So thank you, Mr. Giffen. What I'm hearing you say is that effort is actually occurring within the department's top 10 priorities, and it doesn't need to be singled out and specified as work that the department will do. You're doing that already within your current work plan.
That's right. It's in our current work plan. It's not currently on the top 10 priorities, but it is in our current work plan, the community needs assessment.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Supervisor Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Following up on Supervisor Patterson's comments relative to the olive oil industry, I went to the Olive Festival and I was absolutely stunned by the magnitude of this industry and how it's growing. And so I guess my point, I agree that we need to take a look at the ag tourism. I have no problem whatsoever separating this out, because if you look at the guiding department priorities, paying customers are not adversely affected. Well, I would submit that they are being affected by not being able to do what they need to do. And then 3 and 4, the department should focus on the items forwarding the goals of AB 32 and SB 375 if they can do stuff where they are as opposed to driving other places to get it done. And the final one, focus on the items forwarding the goals and the implementation of the county economic strategy. They all fit. And in my opinion, I think that they fit quite nicely. So I'd like to see that happen. And I'm a little uncomfortable after hearing the last presentation about what's going back to the Planning Commission, or what the Planning Commission is saying about the RCS in terms of the time. I still think that there are a number of things in this resource capacity study that we shouldn't have to deal with every year, even two. I think that could even go out to 3 years in some cases. If we could separate some of that stuff out to reduce the staff workload on that and spend more time on other things. Schools, for example.
I thought we agreed on that, too.
Well, we did, but from what I heard, we're not getting agreement from the Planning Commission on that, from if I heard that correctly.
Do we need to tell who's in charge?
Yeah. I just want to reemphasize the board's direction on this.
Actually, the Planning Commission has not held their first hearing on the amendment, so they'll have that on Thursday, and we can provide your emphasis to the Planning Commission that this was your direction to have the RMS done only every other year.
And I know that the board, we discussed this about doing the every other year. I think I brought up the three-year possibility. And I don't know if there's still latitude in there for some things to be pushed out to that third year time frame so it doesn't encumber staff for a lot of studies on these things.
And we can take a look at that the next time it comes up. And if there are things that don't seem to make sense to be reporting out on, we can note in the report that they'll be reported out on the next time it comes around.
Okay.
Yeah, I support that as well. I think that we did make it kind of clear that there were things such as the school, you know, things that are just not in our purview, that it doesn't really, you know, why spend the time, staff time on gathering data that we don't really ourselves need to use in our own decision making. So, yeah.
And then just one other quick comment, mm-hmm. too, in regard to all of our priorities. When we're looking at things that are not mandated, and I'm going to kind of try to help Supervisor Gibson here a little bit. Earlier today, we talked about trying to supplement some type of funding effort towards health, the health agencies. Well, if we don't do a lot of the things that are being not mandated here and look at these from a priority standpoint, would it be more advantageous to put some of this towards the health-related issues from a funding standpoint? I'm just going to leave it at that and let you ponder that.
Mr. Gibson, I'm sure he's pondering, but...
Let me ponder for a while. No.
Mike Brown won't have to speak then.
That's all right. Well, we obviously have a wide range of worthy initiatives over the breadth of what this county is involved in. As I look this over, you know, we have the top 10 priorities, and we have a number of very large things there. It's exciting to think that some of them are actually nearing completion. That's a good thing. You know, as I look there, the land use and circulation element, you know, the grand plan, the large look at our rural areas is certainly one that's very much in the middle of our strategic growth considerations. And I'd be interested in planning's, not necessarily comments now, but pondering if something came off the top 10 list, is there more resources that could be devoted to that? Maybe we have a top 9 list for a while, because that is obviously a very large thing and very central. In terms of looking at what fills out the top 10 list, I think that's the very reason we have guiding principles, and we are, I think, well along in streamlining processes and making sure that paying customers are taken care of and are mandated things. I think that we do, for the economic benefit of this county, do need to continue the implementation of our strategic growth principles, and there's a number of places in the general plan where that's brought up, one of them being the conservation and open space element recently passed, but not a lot of that being driven directly into implementation. So, you know, as I looked over the possible candidates for, you know, moving toward higher priority, I think there are a range of them, and I'd be interested in, you know, planning's assessment. I'd be interested. I can spot to any number of them that I'm personally interested in, but I think I'd be interested in planning's assessment of how each affects the county as a whole, because that's really what we're trying to do here. You know, conservation open space mitigation program. Complete streets ordinance, again, something very much involved in strategic growth. So I think we have a rich menu to choose from here, and I'd be interested in a little analysis of some of the most obvious ones.
And I would, and before they respond, too, I would agree with what Mr. Gibson's saying, too, and this gets back to my comments on the PD ordinance, which is, you know, we really, if we want to see these policies actually happen on the ground, we need to be able to provide all the tools for the builders to be able to make them happen on the ground, and that's why I also agree with Supervisor Patterson on the, which we've heard quite a lot from builders on infrastructure, certainly the PD ordinance, and I would rather see us as well focus more on some really important items if we're not, if they're not, or if they're taking longer than we had hoped, then necessarily add a lot to the list just as others are completed, but that's something we can talk about. But I do think some of these things that are related to having things set for when hopefully some point banks will lend again and builders will build again, there will be enough tools for them to be able to adapt well. So, but I'll turn it over to Ms. Griffin or Mr. Giffen to respond to our comments.
Well, when we look at our list of current priorities, as Supervisor Gibson alluded to, there's a long list of candidates that we could add. What we try to do when we put our priorities together is also make sure it's balanced with the priorities. Some items that may be worthy of consideration are the San Miguel Community Plan update, which is somewhat on the horizon. Short-lived as it may be, we're going to be putting a really concentrated effort on updating our county economic element, which Mr. Dana Lilly already presented a overview of the work plan. If that was added to the top 10 list, that would be one that would be, I'm expecting, somewhat short-lived because it doesn't have a multi-year work plan associated with it. And I'll ask Ms. Griffin to add onto that list.
The other option is we did receive some grant funding for some items. Mr. Giffen mentioned the complete communities a study that will be done using grant funding that will look at infrastructure needs. So grant-funded projects, typically we hire consultants for, and so they do require less staff time, but they're important enough that you could bring them up to the top 10 list, but we could focus our in-house staffing on the land use and circulation element and plan development ordinance. We would have, staff would have less things on the top 10 list, but those other items would be on the top 10 list as very important. We did receive grant funding also to draft ordinances relative to infill, taking away the obstacles to infill. So both of those items I've heard board members talk about, and yet they wouldn't necessarily consume a lot of staff time, at least not initially.
Mr. Mitchum, if I might just follow up on that. When we talk about staff time, and I look at your list of all of these different things, I mean, some of these are pretty inconsequential. Some of them probably take a lot of time. There's no reference to what time it would take from staff to do these things. And so trying to, I mean, if you piled all these in a big pile and said it takes 25 years to do all these things, I have no idea what, when you look at, let's say, for example, adopt complete streets ordinance. It's a discretionary item. It's not mandated. Amend the titles 22. I don't know how much time is required to do something like that and what the process is by which you get each of these things accomplished. So it makes it a little more difficult when we start looking at trying to replace things from a priority standpoint, because I'm more interested in what can we get done. I'm not interested in about looking out there 25 to 50 years from now. I want to know what we can get done immediately, what we can get done in the next 3 to 5 years, what we can get done from there. And that's how I guess I put my priorities.
So in response, Supervisor Meacham, when we look at the list, as you can tell us, it's a pretty long list. We put that list together in part to also meet the obligations of what Mr. Lope's previous presentation was about. There's certain policies and requirements that we need to continue to monitor and maintain, and a lot of those items on the list have to do with implementation of general plan policies. The other reason we have the list is to have an idea of, well, what is it that's on the list that we need to get done? But when we start looking at estimating how many resources and how many full-time, how many FTEs it's going to take to get those done, we don't necessarily go to the next step and estimate how long and how many resources and how much it's going to cost to get each one of those line items done on tables 1 through 4 done. And what we prefer to do is look at what's realistic and what could actually get done. Then we estimate those individual items and get an idea of how much they're going to cost and how much staff it could take. However, if your board would like us to at least, you know, give a swag on some of those items on lists on list 4, maybe we could do it for, say, the items which are in year 3. We could possibly look at that for the spring update.
Okay, and as a follow-up, and this is not a criticism, but what I hear most often is, how in the world do we have 90-some people in planning when we have nothing going on? Now, I know that there's a lot of things that are going on within the planning department. I understand that. But I think that there needs to be a better job of planning and building to articulate what they're doing to the public, because the public is kind of scratching their head wondering, why is all this money going into planning and building if there's no planning and building going on? So that's just a suggestion to try to, I think, convey to the public exactly what we're doing so that they understand that a little bit better. And me too.
And part of the reason we started to come forward to the board with a priority list was an attempt to do that. And if you look at the bottom, toward the bottom of page 845, what we did there is list 1 are our revenue-generating items. And so we have time and motion studies for each one of those different things that we process. And we look at our revenue projections for each type of project or application that we do, and we came up with the necessary FTEs to get the average projects done. All of our time and motion are the average projects, so they don't take into account really big projects, and they don't take into account real small projects. We hope that on average it'll average out. And for that, we've determined that 33 full-time equivalents are necessary to handle our revenue-generating items. We took the rest of the list, the rest of the items on the lists 2 and 3. As Mr. Giffen pointed out, we don't look out to list 4 until we bring those forward into our current workload. And for each one of those items, determined how much staff time is necessary for each fiscal year. We only do it fiscal year at a time. And for this next fiscal year, we determined that we needed 58 FTEs to get the items on lists 2 and 3 completed. And that does total the number of FTEs we have in the department. Unfortunately, we do have some vacancies, and depending on our revenue, we'll either fill or not fill those vacancies. And so we are working from a deficit right now. And just in general, on the big projects, you can estimate 2 to 3 years to get a large general plan amendment process similar to the conservation and open space element. We pushed that through pretty darn fast. It took just over 3 years to get done.
Yeah. And just to follow up, and not to be taking sides one way or another, but I having worked closely with planning on a few of the bigger priorities that we've had, whether it be the solar projects, which consumed an enormous amount of time from a lot of people in planning, and also I know in county council's office, which I think are of great importance to our county, even on some things that have come up out of the economic development strategy, planning's been there to make themselves available. So I actually think that regardless of the building economy in its current situation, planning is doing a lot of things, including changing, and I think that's partly the result of the committees that you headed, Mr. Meacham, changing a sort of culture to become more business friendly and to become more responsive and to move a little bit more quickly, as we've seen on some projects that I've been able to work with them on and in the commercial side of things. So I feel like they have been increasingly more responsive. Mr. Patterson?
Yes, and to follow up on that, Chairman Hill, some of the work that planning has done over the last 3 years on some of these quote mandated unquote legislative initiatives has positioned us to be able to acquire hundreds of thousands of dollars in grants to help fund some of these activities. So it hasn't all had to come out of the general fund. And I'm curious, Ms. Griffin, I know over the past 3 years we have consistently downsized the department. I believe in the heyday, when the building boom was at full speed, we had upwards of 120 to 130 staff members in planning, and you can correct me on that number. And now we're down to 90. So there have been significant reductions in staffing over the past few years. And I think the work that they're doing currently is not only exemplary work, but also positioning us for the recovery so we can move more effectively and more efficiently. And again, position us so we're eligible for these grants that are being offered by the state.
You're correct, Supervisor Patterson. At the top of the boom, we were about 121. Right before the bust, we were about 114.
Okay. Just a quick follow-up, if I could. Thank you. And I hope you didn't take this as a big criticism, as I understand what staff has to do in a lot of cases. But let me give you an example of one of the discussions we had with the Process Improvement Committee. This was all with a lot of professional folks, and we had John Nall come in and talk about EIRs and the EIR process. That took us all through that session and carried over to another one. So if the professional folks have all the questions relative to that, can you imagine what the public has in terms of trying to understand the magnitude of that process and what's involved from a staff standpoint? So my point is, I think we could do a better job of explaining what we do and why we do it, as opposed to we see this, but a lot of folks don't understand what that means.
Okay, good. Let me go to the public now that we have a chance here. Mr. Rose DeCamp,
did he leave? Yeah, he picked up his grandson.
Oh, okay. We saw him briefly, and it's too bad. We wish him well, our former planning commissioner here. So why don't we go to you, Ms. Pullen. Am I saying it right, GD? Okay, GD Pullen, followed by Mike Brown, please.
Members of the board, I am GD Pullen, and I am so sorry that Bob had to leave because I think he would have done a better job in answering some of your questions. I am currently the president of the board of directors for the Central Coast Olive Growers, and on their behalf, of course, I would like to request and ask you respectfully that you would prioritize the need to change the land use ordinance language to reflect the needs of the olive growers processing olives into oil, extra virgin olive oil, and the marketing from our farms of the product. Bob Rose and another grower, both of them are growers, member growers, drafted a proposal for language and talked to county planning about it, as well as the Ag Commissioner and several of you on this board. All of you have agreed that the language that Bob and the other gentleman, Nick Gladys, proposed would be adequate. So I see moving this into a project priority would not be an enormous time-taking procedure. And certainly the need is very, very real. We're going into harvesting again, and the olive oil will be ready for sale in another month or two or three, the new oil. And certainly growers would be and some might be considered out of compliance with your current rules and policies. It would be enormously important to have that changed. I know Bob would be, because of his expertise, and aren't we lucky, we, the organization, to have him on board with us at this time. And we're very grateful for that. But it, he certainly will be willing, and would be willing, I'm sure, speaking for him, to continue working with anyone on the staff that has questions on how this could be expedited. So...
So you're volunteering Mr. Rose for as much time as necessary.
Absolutely.
I think that's a good...
I volunteered to pick up his grandchildren from the school but, so he could be here, but that was not acceptable. And so at this point, if you have any questions, I would be more than happy to try to answer them. If not, I would hope that you will give this your highest consideration and grant us this request.
Thank you
so very much.
Thank you, Ms. Bowen. I appreciate that. Mr. Brown, followed by Mike Wynn.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. You know, at the top of your list of the top 10 is the permit streamlining measures. Your planning department newsletter for August has a lead article on it. It ends up that the department is committed to continuous improvement. But it's hard to know anecdotally what's really happening. So we saw at the Planning Commission a few weeks ago an applicant who had a ranch over on the coast that took 3 years to get a conditional use permit to have weddings. Okay, 3 years. We saw a few weeks ago at the board where the bank that inherited that violation has to come up with $450,000 or something to advance affordable or a workplace housing project. And so, and you have said, some of you today, that you thought things were getting better, so it's kind of anecdotal. So one of the things would be to have some real metrics about cost and velocity of permitting. You have all the raw numbers. They're on your website under building permit activity, and it lists all sorts of things, and it's a good chart. Has the exact counts for all these different types of permits and subdivisions and CUPs and everything, and most of them are way down from even last year. But the real thing would be to apply cost and velocity numbers to those. So how long does it take to get a conditional use permit or an over-the-counter permit or whatever it is for a particular thing? And how many of them are there? And then you would know if it's getting better. So it's cost, that is the cost in fees to the county. It's cost in terms of what it takes the applicant to pay geologists or architects or engineers or whatever it is to do the project. And then it's cost of whatever it is you require them to do to comply with the permit conditions. That's the cost side. And then there's the velocity side. How long does it take on balance to get through these things? And there are actually so few of them in your own report, you ought to be able to know exactly, and you're billing them for hours, so you know. And then over time, you could trend that and know if the permit streamlining measures are actually working and creating value to help people. So we would recommend that. Thank you very much.
Hey, Mr. Brown. Mr. Wynn, followed by Eric Greening.
Chairman Hill, Supervisors, my name is Mike Wynn. I'm from Napomo, and I chair your Water Resource Advisory Committee. And I'm only going to speak to one issue today, and that is the resource management system that has the annual survey report. I'd like just to make two suggestions to you. They clearly don't have to come out every year to be useful to you. We do not see water tables and watersheds changing radically in a year's time. And so since that's our primary focus, I think there would be no loss of value if you did it less frequently. My suggestion is not to do it every other year, do it four times in 10 years. Now, the reason I asked for that timing is that, as you probably know, cities and CSDs have to update their urban water master plan every 5 years. So typically, in years that end with 0 and 5, our work has to be updated and submitted. In addition to which, we always have our annual reports to go to the DWR, so you could choose any year for that purpose. But if you chose your years following our updates, you would get the most current data, and it would be done fairly quickly. So if you did yours in the years that end with 1 and 6, let's say, you can work out the details with your staff. And then the other two times were either 2 years after or 3 years after that, depending on whether you can get a planning grant, depending on whether you have other things that come up for your priorities. You would have 4 reports in 10 years, and they'd be excellent, I think. Just one suggestion. The alternate years, the years that end with 1 and 6, need to focus primarily on getting the best, most current data you can find. The alternate years, you could actually change formatting. You could completely reformulate it if you chose to. And so you could tweak things then that you wouldn't want to take time out for when you were doing your hard work. The cities, CSDs, your own dependent service districts, all of these have very valuable data. And these reports can be very useful to you and to your planning department. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Eric?
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and a word that has come up in your discussions that a lot of people like to throw around these days is infrastructure. And the assumption that's usually made with that word is it's about building stuff. Presumably it's about building something new, not necessarily taking care of or operating or keeping going, which always should be our first option. And so if we're going to discuss infrastructure, meaning public services, public amenities, I want to be sure that the operational side gets on the table with at least equal prominence and as a preference. I recognize that to some extent anything that's funded from one-time approvals is more likely to be a one-time deliverable rather than a keep something going deliverable, and that's kind of a problem we have with the way these the developments are funded and what they fund. But it is a very real issue. I mean, what we're seeing right now, for example, if we're going to talk about infrastructure in Templeton, downtown Templeton has lost transit service. It still has bus benches and signs. But when the North County Shuttle stopped existing and pieces of it were picked up by other systems, the Atascadero system did not pick up downtown Templeton. The Route 9 doesn't go there. No one goes there. Recently, you approved a project that was supposedly going to be in walking distance of transit. Well, it isn't, because that has gone away. This doesn't require us to build anything. I wish the president was hearing this. The most shovel-ready jobs are the keep-things-going jobs. He's trying to cram his probably-won't-go-anywhere stimulus through the Senate today before it goes nowhere in the House later this week. But it's not offering one penny for transit operations. Lots of roads, a little bit of transit capital. But when we're discussing infrastructure, can we call it something like public services and amenities so that the keeping stuff going part gets equal time and prominence with the we need to build stuff part? The we need to build stuff part usually has huge lead times. The keeping stuff going part may mean that we rescue what we have so that it actually serves the people right away and forestalls the need for the build stuff part. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. That'll do it for public comments, so we'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board. Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're looking for some direction to staff here, and I was seeing three sort of, well, two broad categories. One specific issue being the RMS system, which is about to start planning commission hearings. That's really an ordinance change or general plan change that would get it onto a more spaced out than every year plan. I think that's good. I think with the RMS system, though, there is a much bigger conversation to be had about truly capturing regional issues in terms of those resources and infrastructure items that would support strategic growth. And that's at a countywide level, the sustainable community strategy that's part of SB 375, as well as our own strategic growth principles. And those things, two things have to mesh. So, I'm inclined to let the RMS system work its way through the Planning Commission. Staff's clearly going to make our interests known, and that is to reduce staff load on this, but I think there's a bigger conversation yet to come. And then as things get accomplished, we're being asked to refresh our priorities, which I think is an excellent exercise. The 3 years we've been doing it have been very, very helpful. And I think the clear sense that I get is that we want to hear some options coming forward to be part of the top priorities, the so-called top 10 lists of the department. And from my perspective, I'd like staff to use our guiding principles. That's what they're there for, to bring forward a selection of the most likely candidates. It might be useful to have them both long-term and short-term, things that, might get accomplished quickly and others that we need to get started on for our consideration. Certainly the cost, whether there's potential for grant funding or whether it's a pure general fund kind of support, are things that we need to consider as we wrestle with them, and whether among those options we have the idea of added effort on ones that are already in the mix. So that seems to me to be the way we do things, and that seems to me to be the next step on that. I do have a question. Among the specifics is to bring forward these issues regarding olive oil processing. I have no problem separating it from the rest of the ag amendments. I'm not quite sure why it was part of the ag tourism amendments in the first place. It seems like a pretty straightforward ag processing question. But I am curious about the term boutique processing. Right now, restricting olive oil processing to only product grown on site is one thing. I understand the constrictions of that. But I wonder, when we start talking about processing from off-site, whether we're looking at, potentially large. What are the environmental, what do we have to consider when we open it up like that? And what does boutique mean? Because I've never been to one. So.
our understanding is that it's the way that the oil is processed. So a large commercial manufacturer of olive oil, like Star Olive Oil, processes their olive oil very differently than Mr. Rose does when he creates his specialty product. And by adding that, the way it's processed into the ag processing definition, so that it only addresses those at a small scale and not the larger commercial scale, we feel like we won't get into the problem of having someone like Crisco or something come in.
Standard Oil.
Yeah.
I guess they're not in that business. But Okay.
And I was persuaded by Mr. Meacham on the olive oil, and kind of like the idea that we may develop this appellation here for olive oil, which is a nice thing. Mr. Meacham?
I need a little bit of clarity, if I could, please, on the one of the items we have is complete the Paso's groundwater basin resource capacity study. What are we doing in that regard? We have a committee that's been established for the groundwater management plan to take a look at that. So what exactly are we doing with this capacity study? Are we waiting for them to put an implementation management plan in place? Which comes first?
So this is one of those items that's now done. So the resource capacity study itself is complete. Your board took action on that. And included in that was a number of recommendations. So what we're replacing that one with is implementation of those recommendations that were part of the resource capacity study.
Okay, and then further back in one of the number of items here,
was talking about a countywide conservation plan, water conservation plan, if I remember correctly, seeing that somewhere. Is that, and I would assume that one of the things that's going to come out of the steering committee or this task force on the groundwater basin, Paso groundwater basin, is a conservation plan of some sort. So is this tying together with the countywide conservation plan or?
Yeah, Supervisor Meacham, the short answer is yes. Probably the best way to answer your question is if you turn to page A-417. And at the top of that page, it gives a high-level summary of the amendments that would need to be made to the ordinance to implement the recommendations from the RCS.
But is there a wider countywide water conservation issue?
I thought that there was someplace in there. I thought I saw a countywide water conservation effort, but maybe I'm wrong. I find that hard to believe that I'm wrong. But
I can't think of one that the closest is our coordination with Public Works on the water master plan.
Water master plan.
Maybe, right.
Maybe
that might have been. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Are you done, Mr. Meacham?
Yeah, I'm
sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, too, I've been tracking them and actually attending the advisory subcommittee meetings on the Paso Robles Groundwater Basin Management Plan, and that's really being handled by Public Works. And certainly the RMS recommendations that you're working on will be a part of that management plan. It will affect it in some way, but it's the land use portion of it, not the actual water resource utilization portion, which the management plan will address. And that process is moving forward, and hopefully we'll have something back to this board. If not by late this year, early next year. They're working on some recommendations now, including a conservation piece for that basin specifically. But I wanted to just comment also on the olive oil processing request. Mr. Rose did provide some language that would be a rather simple fix. And I'm curious to know, and I did meet with him and others on this issue, as I know my colleagues did. I'm curious to know if you think the recommendation that he has made in terms of the language is sufficient, if it's as simple as implementing or incorporating that language into the ordinance.
We think that's a really good start to addressing the issue. There's some broader issues that we'd like to address at the same time, and that's the on-site sales and tasting. And I think that the olive oil or olive growers, you can't grow olive oil, the olive growers would also like to address as part of these two. So it's a little broader than the language that Mr. Rose has provided, but that's a really, really good start. That was where we were struggling with how do you separate the big manufacturers from the small manufacturers, and the language he provided is what we needed.
What is your time estimate? Should we ask you to move that forward?
We could probably have an amendment through environmental review, draft out for review to the public. This may generate some controversy. In the past, when we've brought olive oil processing forward under our current regulations, we have had quite large turnouts at minor use permit hearings, depending on the location of where the facility is. So we'd send it out for public review, do the environmental review, go to Planning Commission, come forward to your board, by 6 to 9 months.
Okay. Mr. Meacham?
If I could, just a follow-up. A-422, Table 4, fourth bullet point down, adopt countywide water conservation ordinance.
We found it.
Very good. That is in our out there years. So it's not something we're currently
ordinance.
Working on.
That, I mean, the key word there is groundwater management ordinance, it sounds like.
Okay.
Oh, no, not groundwater management, water conservation.
Conservation.
Setting standard, that would be setting standards on water consumption for
right.
a dwelling unit. Or
right.
Okay. Does staff feel like it has sufficient direction? Mr. Patterson?
Yes, thank you. Just one question relative to that. The state has actually adopted landscape water use criteria, and how will the county incorporate those mandates into our current policies? Does that require an ordinance amendment, and is that what motivated this issue here?
No, what motivated this that's back on Table 4 is actually a policy in the conservation and open space element. Mm-hmm. The landscape ordinance, the model landscape ordinance that mm-hmm. was adopted by the state, and local jurisdictions had to either adopt the model or show that what they had in place was equivalent relative to landscape. We actually provided the state with information that what we have in place is equivalent to the model ordinance. But we'll be looking at pieces of that model ordinance to see if there's good ideas to bring forward as part of the resource capacity study, the Paso Robles Groundwater Basin Resource Capacity Study. We chose not to use the method that the state used, but it might work well for the groundwater basin, so we're going to look at it.
Great. Thank you.
Further comments?
Okay. So perhaps just in closing, mm-hmm. If we're able to complete, like I said at the beginning of the presentation, a significant chunk of priorities off our top 10 list, we'll be coming back in the spring. We've got good direction on making sure that we provide you with options on resources and how long things are going to take. We have probably a short list of about 6 or 7 items. As far as the economic strategy items, we will be recommending that we replace the current top 10 item with the economic element update. Some other short list items that I've heard today from the discussion are items related to the grant funding to encourage infill, the grant funding for community the complete communities strategy. I mentioned the San Miguel community plan, olive oil, ag tourism, GMO RMS changes, and we also have one on the short list, which is mobile home park zoning. So we've got about 6 to 8 options, which we'll be presenting for some of those slots when we come around in the spring, and they'll have resources and time, and we'll continue to tell our story.
Okay. Good. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Wait, Mr.
Patterson. Mr. Giffen, I'm assuming that presentation will be in conjunction with your work plan and the fiscal year 12-13 budget. It'll be part of that, incorporated in with that discussion. Or will that be coming back prior to that discussion?
I think the timing of the next strategic planning session will. Well, it will happen concurrently while we're going through the process of our budget update. And as Mr. Buckshy explained this morning, the budget hearing schedule, we'll be looking at that in concert with our own budget that we develop. But we'll likely be coming back to your board, I think it's in February.
Towards the end of
February.
So you can take our recommendations at that time and fold them into your work plan and budget for the next fiscal year. Is the idea.
That would be the plan.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. All right. We shall adjourn until next Tuesday, the 18th. Thank you very much.
Wow.